Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, happy Sunday. This is Seeds of Change, and I'm your host, Danielle St. John. So today we're going to switch it up just a little bit, and Elizabeth is needing a little break, which I don't blame her at all, and Mom's a little sick today. So it's going to be me and Lily today. So we are going to be still trying to stick to the food news and health topics. But I really do want to talk a little bit about student loan forgiveness and what I'm seeing. So I'm not sure why so many people are freaking out about, you know, kind of helping out the little guy and not saying anything about corporate subsidies and all of these things. So but here we are. So I would love, if you guys want to call in and give your opinion on it, that's great. I would love to hear from you. And as soon as Lily is ready, we can get started on that. Well, in the meantime, I guess we can talk about, there she is. Go ahead and push one, Lily. Go.
Hi.
Hello. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. Thank you. I'm still kind of like fascinated, I guess, at people's reaction to the student loan issue. And so I guess we could talk about that first, either that or we can start with food. What are you thinking?
I'm fine with either. I'm still kind of laughing about the student loan thing because I don't mean to disrespect people, but I also don't think that they sometimes pay attention, you know, because it's literally like with $10,000 or $20,000, all you're really doing is getting rid of a little bit of the interest rate that's super high and steep anyway that people have to pay. Like, you're not actually paying off their student loans, you know? And really, like, it's all going to collapse anyway, so I don't, you know, like, really know why it matters in some ways. But maybe that's just because I'm crazy and feral. I don't know. But I just think it's funny that people are so angry about it. Like, people who claim to hate the government specifically, you know, and know that, first of all, taxation is theft. And so I think we need to unite and stop participating in that part of the game anyway. But But for people to be so, like, we hate the government, but also we're really angry that you're not going to pay the government and the bankers for loans, it's, like, weird to me.
It is a weird double standard. And the Christian element, right? So, and especially because most of the hate is coming from, you know, the right side of this argument, it's like, you know, so you want to get back to Christian values, except Jubilee is nowhere, you know, it's just completely written off. And I've actually heard the argument several times today that that's an Old Testament thing, and so Christians don't have to believe it. But I'd like to know where in the Bible it says that the Old Testament doesn't apply anymore. And if it doesn't apply anymore, why is it still in there?
Right. And it doesn't make any sense because it's not written like an actual, like, novel, you know, that you start at the beginning and you finish at the end. Like, you are meant to jump around. That's why there are parts of Revelation in Daniel and all kinds of other books, and not only in their own chapter, you know, because it's supposed to be a living book that is continuous and not ending, you know, and so you can't just read it cover to cover and then feel like you're done with it, you know. There are applicable
exactly.
things that are still, and if the Old Testament was no longer utilized, there wouldn't be, you know, like it wouldn't make any sense because you wouldn't have, you know, the list of commandments that we're supposed to follow, for example, then those
right.
would
or
also be null and void. Right. Yeah.
They'd be like, who's this?
I think
who's
people
this?
Just like
who's
to
this?
Cherry
new,
pick.
New book, who's this? Yeah. I don't know. It's just really, really strange to me. And the fact that the right is the triggered side this time. It's usually the left that is triggered about things. But at this point, it's the right, and it's like, you know, pay your own debt. Okay, but not corporations don't have to do that. Like when corporations have write-offs, it, you know, it's these are subsidies and it's you know, helping the economy. But when we're talking about scraps for people who really, really need it, it's all, everybody's losing their minds. And I, you know, and I keep going back to the number 21 trillion because that's what's missing from the Pentagon budget. That's what's missing from the Pentagon budget since 2001. Matter of fact, September 10th, 2001 is when Donald Rumsfeld came out and told the whole world that there were, I believe, $9 trillion missing at that point. And then nobody
yes.
talked about it again because the next day, you know, 9/11 happened. So that,
right.
that was the kind of the start of it. And here we are, you know, 20 years later, and it's and there's $21 trillion missing. How can anybody, in this country still put any kind of faith in our currency when this is a fact, when we have, I mean, that's the size of our national debt is $21 trillion. And people still think money is anything but silly paper if, you know, but nobody wants to talk about that. Nobody wants to talk about the fact that our money is an illusion. And the only
right.
thing that gives it its value is us. We are the currency.
Exactly. Well, and it's weird to me on so many levels, too, because, you know, like the right, a lot of the right, because I'm independent, so I'm neither, you know, necessarily, but the right is also really excited about the concept of Nacera Jacera and, you know, Donald Trump assisting in enacting Nacera Jacera protocols. Because the reality is that the Fed stole all of the real currency from all of our ancestors and gave them debt notes. Like that fiat
yeah.
banknote paper currency that, you know, we pretend is real and it's really monopoly money is a debt note explaining to you that they owe you money, like real money that is, you know, like gold and silver and precious metals, because they stole all of that with the promise to give it back. And just never gave it back. You know, just like income tax was supposed to be temporary and then became permanent because everybody went along with it. And so I don't understand
yeah.
how you can be excited about Nacera Jacera and everybody being paid back what was stolen from their ancestors, you know, by the Fed and by the fake de facto corporate government, and then be mad about forgiveness of $10,000 or $20,000 of an interest rate of a student loan. You know, like it's really weird.
Right, right. And I think it's really, you know, a symptom of the people just reacting to the news that they're exposing themselves to. You know, like you can really tell, you know, who watches Fox and who watches CNN and who watches, you know, MSNBC because their thoughts are really structured by the arguments that are being given on these platforms. And it's very reactionary and, you know, and for such a small amount, I mean, in really the grand scheme of things, the amount of money that's going to be spent on, you know, this small amount of student loan forgiveness, it's not proportionate to the reaction that I'm seeing. So I'm not sure what that's about.
Well, I think that you hit the nail on the head. You know, it is about people paying too much attention to the media because in my opinion, you know, this is another, just another distraction to get the masses to fight each other instead of paying attention to the real problem and fighting our common enemy, you know, and out creating our common enemy, instead they would rather us to be screaming and fighting with each other, you know, based on bankers being paid back that should be arrested anyway.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of comical to me, just because I don't feel like it's a real thing that anyone should be mad about or celebrating either.
Yeah, but it's all over my timeline. It's like, you know, every other post seems to be about student loan forgiveness. Nobody's talking about the billions that we sent to Ukraine anymore. Nobody's talking about $21 trillion missing from the Pentagon budget. Nobody's talking about the seven wars that we're in, you know?
Right. It's really frustrating. I just got out of Facebook jail, and I was excited to, like, hang out with people in that forum and talk to them, but I haven't really been commenting because, you know, like, it's just all, like, boring and really three-dimensional and not real to me anyway, and so, you know, so it's not fun.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And even, you know, somebody that I consider a friend just is, like, you know, basically treating me like I'm Bill Bunting. You know what I mean? Like, we know your secret. We know, you know, we know what you did. We know that you're a communist, hypocrite, selfish thief. And, you know, and just crazy, crazy stuff just for having a difference of opinion. I don't even have student loan debt. Come on. You know what I mean? And somehow, because I agree with this, I'm, you know, she's funding my life in California and she can't afford to live here. So, you know, I must be stealing money, and who gives a fuck about my chickens, she says. Okay.
Well, this person, if it's who I think it is, emotionally reacts to everything while pretending that she doesn't, so it's really hypocritical anyway. And she, you know, does live feeds. She doesn't do them anymore because she was doing live feeds and then lied to everyone's face about a situation that was then put in national media that she was lying about. You know, that she tried to pretend it away. So I take everything that anyone says with a grain of salt, but especially that particular person.
Yeah, yeah.
If it's the same person that we're that I'm talking about.
Yeah, starts with an M.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, right, you know, but I guess it was just the, you know, and I get yelled at all the time online. I'm not trying to say that's something that usually bothers me, but this came out of the blue. It's not like I went after her or anything. She posted, tagged me in something, and then just went on and on and on and on and on in the comments about things that I'm like, what are you talking about? This woman has never said anything negative to me ever, maybe behind my back, who knows? But like, how, I mean, unity is the only way out of this. And so when people who know this, I wonder what's going on, because it's more than just me having an opinion on something. It's like she's treating me like I went into her house, you know, punched her kid in the face and stole a $20 bill. You know what I mean? Like, it's the reaction is not proportionate to me having an opinion that differs. So
right. It's a very visceral reaction, and again, you know, it's really strange to me, because I feel like the conversation, people that are mad about student loans having to pay them, you know, like that owe student loans, and people that are mad about, you know, the government pretending to forgive people's student loans, should both just unite instead on, okay, taxation is theft. It shouldn't exist anyway in the capacity that it does. There are ways to get out of that and to defeat that system, which would collapse the entire fucking thing anyway. So why don't we put our heads together and figure that out, right, and get that done? Because it was almost done. A group called RUSA actually was able to uninstall all 50 governors and reinstall governors that were aligned with natural law and sovereignty. And the only reason that they lost was because they ended up calling it a religious organization. And because they did that, you know, like, it collapsed everything that they had worked towards doing, and then the IRS came in and arrested them. And so, you know, like, there are ways to get that done, though. It's just not falling for the little traps with, like, verbiage and things, you know? And so I really feel like that is where everyone's focus should be, not on who has student loans, who's paying them, who's not paying them, but rather how do we end, you know, like giving all of this money to the Fed to go wage wars, you know, and to destroy other people's lives and to do all these really heinous things that most of us don't agree with. We could just end all of that rather than fighting back and forth online about something stupid, in my opinion.
Yes, yes, totally. So the fact that, you know, for the past, gosh, what is it, since 2018. So, yeah, so since 2018, I've been focusing most of my energy on, you know, ways to that we can separate ourselves from this evil system. And, you know, so I don't know. Like, I guess I'm going to continue to do that. But somehow all of a sudden, all of that work is gone. Nobody remembers any of that, and I'm just, you know, an evil Democrat Bernie supporter somehow. So maybe we should just focus, you know, refocus on those kind, on fixing this our lives so that we are not reliant on this system anymore, and really understand that these predatory systems were designed to keep us in debt and designed to keep us fighting and struggling. And the sooner we can walk away from it, the better. And all of a sudden now we're all right back into the, you know, believing the system is the only way that we're going to survive. It's really unfortunate. So, I mean, I guess with that, I mean, why don't we focus on, you know, on the food aspect of it now? I mean, I guess that's really the only thing that we can keep doing besides, you know, I'm trying not to fixate on this, but it really is such a strange behavior that I keep going back to it. So what do you say we play a video or an audio on some survival foods again?
Yeah, that sounds great. And I'm sorry, by the way, if I was, like, overly, like, rude about it or anything. I just am also confused about why it is so important to either side, you know? Like, I mean, I get kind of, like, yeah, the Democrats because they're weird, but, like, and I don't always agree with the right, but I find myself the last, like, few years especially agreeing with them a lot more than the left. But this is just, like, a weird thing, you know, that doesn't make any sense to me either.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So this is my favorite guy. Kevin Espiritu. He's got the Epic Gardener channel. And this is five fast-growing veggies that and a lot of times you can grow these inside. So, you know, for those who have that problem with winter, which we don't have over here. But
right.
Okay, here we go.
If it's your first time gardening, I'm of the belief that getting a win under your belt is a huge moment. That first harvest is something you never forget. That's why in this video, we're going to go over five different crops or families of crops that you can grow in under a month. Kevin Espiritu here from Epic Gardening, where it is my goal to help you grow a greener thumb. All right, my first harvest was so bad. I mean, I tried to go from 0 to 100, like boom, like that. And I did hydroponic cucumbers just straight out of the gate, which tasted terrible. I didn't feed them the right nutrients. And so how do we avoid these problems? Well, that's what this video is for. Easy harvest. So in this video, we're going through the fastest to the slowest all within a month. So we're going to talk about some stuff you can grow in 10 days, and we're going to talk about some stuff that pushes up right against that month mark. And at the end, I'm going to take some recommendations from this video from my garden and whip it into a simple garden salad just to show you kind of how I actually use this stuff. So cultivate that like button if you want 20 years of good harvests, and we're going to need it these days. And let's get into the video. Fast crop number one is microgreens. Now, the only reason that I'm showing you these seeds that I'm starting is because I don't have a tray of microgreens right now, but I've done so many videos and it's one of my favorite crops to grow actually. So I have an entire 45-minute guide on microgreens, but let's talk about them really quickly. Number one, the fastest crop you're ever gonna get are microgreens. What are they? In a nutshell, it's basically just growing plants more or less to this point and then harvesting them. So it's the same seeds that you would use to grow a plant to its full form, but you just plant way more of them and you plant them very densely along a tray like this. So you'd usually use like a 10 by 20 tray. You'd seed it very heavily, and then you'd water that in, and they'd grow in this big mat. It's kind of like those chia pets. And in fact, you can actually grow chia microgreens if you wish. Now, the reason I like them, number one, they're fast. Number two, highly nutritious. Number three, you can cycle grow them. You can keep succession sowing them. Tray after tray can come out of the garden. And they're very easy to work into recipes. You just harvest them off, chop them up, put them into a salad, a soup, whatever you want to do, and they're good to go. So again, I have massively detailed and in-depth guides on microgreens already on my channel, but I do want to show you some things. Basically, this is the stage that you would harvest a microgreen at. Seeds have seed leaves, cotyledons, cotyledons, however you pronounce that, but those are the leaves that are actually already structurally within the seed. When it sprouts, those ones are the first to show up, and they don't look like the typical seed from that plant. So if you're growing arugula, the seed leaves don't look like an arugula leaf. The first set of what we call true leaves is right around the point that you'd want to harvest a microgreen. And so you can see right here, we have some true leaves, and the reason I know that is because right down below, specifically on this one right here, it's very easy to see, we have some seed leaves. Those are like the little baby boys, and then these ones come out. Now imagine you have an entire tray of these, then that's a really nice meal in 8 to 12 days. Some crops take longer. Basil, for example, could be 21 days, but that's still an entire tray of micro basil at 3 weeks. So fantastic first crop in our fast crops guide. Second group of crops, peas and sunflowers. They're technically still microgreens. A lot of the times they're sold as microgreens, but they do look quite a bit different, and I kind of group them in a different way. So these are pea shoots. These are pea shoots that are probably going to go into my garden to grow as actual peas, but I could certainly just literally eat these right now. They have a nice, fresh, vegetal pea flavor, high in nutrition, and they're very easy to sprout. You know, peas, you soak them, the seeds, for a little bit if you want to. You don't even have to do that. And then once these come up, you can literally just eat those right there, and that tastes really nice, really fresh pea flavor. Very easy. Now over here on this side right here, we have some sunflowers. Sunflowers, in fact, are probably my favorite microgreen of all time to grow because they really retain that nutty flavor, which is really unique. You wouldn't expect them to, but they do. They kind of just taste like a greener version of a sunflower seed. And it's a very fresh, refreshing flavor, and I really love doing sunflowers. Now, the thing about sunflowers when you're growing the microgreens is you do want to soak them, and you do want to make sure you're watching out for mold and such, because it's just a bigger seed, more things can go wrong, but still, you're getting these in 12 to 15 days. Okay, our third group of crops, it's going to be the whole world of baby lettuce, baby greens. Now, what's great about this example right here is you can see I have some loose leaf lettuce here that's very mature, very adult. Behind us, we have loose leaf lettuce that is, 2-3 weeks old. And then this stuff here is just transplanted in about 4 or 5 days ago. And so you can see how we talked about microgreens earlier in the video. Well, this is the natural growth cycle of lettuce. It's growing up. Microgreens harvested very, very young, but if you let that same exact plant go a little longer, then you can harvest right here, you can harvest right here for a micro head of lettuce, or you can let it go and harvest around here, although this is longer than a month. Now, what I'll say about this is if you're planning to specifically harvest at a younger stage of life, then your spacing should be a little different. So right here, I'm spacing around 4 per square foot, and that's because I've planned for them to be about this big. So I've spaced them roughly 4 or 5 inches apart. But if I know I'm going to be harvesting my lettuce at these sizes back here, then I can plant them much more densely. So I might plant them at 9 per square foot, and then I know that once they kind of start filling up that space, clip, 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 take them into the garden, the kitchen, and then start cooking up a great meal. Our fourth group are the greens of root crops. Yes, you can eat the greens of all root crops, and in fact, some of these are my favorite greens to eat. What we're looking at right here in the foreground are beets. Beet greens can be eaten, and in fact, sometimes I actually prefer them. I like these beet greens nice and sauteed, and some olive oil, some onion, some garlic. It's a really nice flavor. And sometimes, you know, the beets aren't as appetizing to me. So you can definitely grow beet greens, radish greens, and turnip greens, and you can just harvest them for their greens before they start to bulb up. There's nothing wrong with that. They germinate fast, and they grow fast. Now, I will say, you can get baby radishes. Sometimes the beets take a little longer. Turnips, you can get baby turnips to some degree, but baby radishes can definitely be harvested at that 30-day mark. You can get a really nice crop of radishes. In fact, Let's just go ahead and show you kind of what you can get here if you wait just a little bit longer. See this? This is a great example of a baby little root crop that you could harvest in a really short amount of time. Our fifth group of crops is what I'm going to call upgraded greens, some more fancy and cool ones. So we have a whole mess of kale back here. This is certainly older than 30 days, but again, baby kale is oftentimes more tender. It can be a little bit sweeter, a little bit less fibrous, and it's very tasty. So sometimes the baby kale is a lot easier to use in a salad, especially if you don't like kind of crunching through this. I personally am probably going to turn this into kale chips, but you can see a different cultivar of kale here. This is dazzling blue kale, which is quite beautiful, and the main vein down each leaf has this amazing, amazing color, but the leaves are also much more tender, much fresher. And so kale is a fantastic elevated green that you can grow in under 30 days. Another elevated green that you can grow in less than 30 days, certainly not one of this size, but it is bok choy or pak choy. I recommend getting a dwarf or baby bok choy variety. They're very cute, and you can kind of just pluck them out, throw them in a stir fry. They're very good. Here's another one right here. This is Benihushi Mizuna, or it's basically a mustard, which kind of gives that nice peppery, spicy flavor to either a salad or a stir fry. So there's a lot of different, you know, extra greens besides the world of loose leaf lettuce or these more simple greens. Now that we have our list of quick growing crops, I've got my beet that I pulled out for you guys earlier, and we're going to grab a couple more selections here and whip it up into a really quick garden fresh salad. So I'm going to take this loose leaf lettuce right here because it's looking really good. Boom, that's amazing. This is maybe, it's a little longer than a month, maybe 35 days or so, I would say. And Mizuna, this is the Benihushi Mizuna. The flowers are edible, so I'm going to take the flowers for a garnish. Just take a couple of those. And I'm also going to take some leaves on my kale back here. Again, this is an older kale, but the same rules apply and the same theory applies. So we're just going to grab from the oldest leaves, getting those oldest leaves first, cut and come again style, which I have a video on my channel. And look at that. This plant is still rocking and rolling. It's looking really good. But we've cleaned it up a little bit. We've let some more light in. And we have a nice little micro salad here that we're going to turn into really quick.
Okay, so I think the rest of this video is more audio. I mean, other way around, audio is more video. So I put a link to it in our chat if you're listening on the computer, there's a chat feature. So I put it in there. That's like one of the problems being limited with just audio is that some of this information, you know, needs to be seen as well as heard. So. But anyway, but that's a pretty good list of things that you could grow very easily. And with light, you know, you could, a lot of this stuff doesn't have to necessarily be done out in the garden. But you know, grow lights work just as well. And it may come to that, especially for places, you know, who have colder winters. They're going to need to figure out the solar panels and a way to get your lights to work, because that may be something that we will have to fall back on.
Right. Well, and even the Farmer's Almanac, sorry, I can't say words, I guess, was saying that we're supposed to have a colder winter with a lot more snow this year. You know, and so, of course, with HARP, I'm certain that they will take advantage of that.
Yeah, for sure. So,
but that will only force
like,
unity as well.
What's that? Say that again.
Oh, I just think that will also, like, force unity for us, you know, like if we have to share food with each other. then we'll be forced to unite since we're not making the choice to do it right now for unknown reasons. Mm-hmm.
Exactly, exactly. And that's where, like, I guess I really differ from the people who have the Mad Max zombie apocalypse, you know, mind frame that, like, people will just, you know, come over and kill you and take your food. But, like, you know, every zombie apocalypse movie I see where people are huddled in a mall or whatever, you know, I don't think they were asking about political identity with those people at the time. So all of these artificial, you know, divisions that they, that we allow them to put on us are going to be gone because of necessity very soon.
Right. And I'm hopeful about it. You know, I mean, even in those, like, movies, but also in real life when there are, you know, like, different disasters that go on, you know, there are a few opportunists that cause problems, but for the most part, I see people uniting regardless of similar beliefs or cultures or not, you know, because everybody has the basic desire to survive. And to do that, we need each other. And so I really don't foresee, you know, like a situation where we're all killing each other to get things. I mean, I guess like that could occur. I'm not going to manifest that. But I think that will only occur in places where people are being extremely individualized. Like, I'm only going to grow enough food for my family, or you don't only do this for my family. Then, yeah, people might go and try to attack them and steal their things. But if you are providing food so that everybody has access, then there is no, you know, there's not like this unhealthy competition of wanting to kill other people to steal from them or to destroy them. Rather, there's just everybody able to live.
Exactly. Yeah. Working to live together. And that's honestly, like, if we could just, you know, unfortunately it seems things are going to be bad before people want to make these changes, want to get rid of, you know, this government structure that keeps us all enslaved, right? So it seems that we're going that way where we all see the writing on the wall. We all see what's going on, how food distribution lines are getting cut, how, you know, gas prices through the roof, banning, you know, gas-powered cars in California. You know what I mean? Like, the people are going to walk away from this system out of necessity. And I wish we could have done it just because we knew that the system was unsustainable. I wish that more people would have done it. But unfortunately, it's going to happen. It's just going to happen out of necessity. So I think we all need to make sure that we can feed our communities. Number one, like, that's the number one thing. People aren't going to be, you know, really worried about, you know, brand name clothes or whatever, having the right handbag. They're going to be worried about, you know, where their food is coming from. And that's probably pretty easy to provide food for everybody if we start now. Probably should have started 5 years ago.
Right.
If we start now, we can do it.
Right. I mean, even just guerrilla gardening is a great way, mm-hmm. you know, and it's extremely easy. Like, it's not difficult. It's not expensive, you know, but I think that there is, you know, because our shadow selves get brought into the light, you know, so that we can see what needs to be worked on and fix it. And I am seeing a lot of kind of like selfishness and greed coming to the surface for a lot of people, which is okay, you know, because like better to come to light now and then people can address it rather than continue going that way. But this false sense of scarcity that the corporate government places on the people and the media portrays to the people, I think, is the cause of a lot of that. You know, I think that most people are good-natured and would, you know, would not mind other people succeeding. But I think that they feel threatened by it currently because they have a false scarcity situation, you know, where they think that it's either them or somebody else, and both people cannot win and succeed at the same time, but only one person mm-hmm. can. And that's unfortunate, you know, because that's just not how it is. But it's fine because
right.
it will just get exposed and addressed, you know, in that way.
Absolutely.
I'm really sorry. My allergies are weird today, so I don't mean to have to keep clearing my throat like that.
Oh, no, you're fine. I'm so glad you're here. I was thinking about just skipping this week, but I'm really enjoying so far what's going on. So thank you for being here, giving up part of your afternoon.
Yeah, thanks for letting me be here.
Yeah. So there was some kind of a Supreme Court ruling that I was just starting to research that basically, like, I think it was RFK Jr. Went to the Supreme Court and got the Supreme Court confirms that damage caused by by COVID mRNA gene therapy is irreparable. So that's supposedly RFK Jr. got, no wonder he got his account taken away, because, you know, that really goes against this, their narrative that they're safe and effective, because they're neither.
Right. It's huge. And it's all starting to come to light, you know. Unfortunately, I wish that people would have believed it earlier and avoided getting those gene therapy shots. But, you know, better now than never to come out. And, I mean, I even saw, like, recently it was trending on Twitter, stop the shot. And so even, you know, some of the people that follow, like, the mainstream media and believe in the propaganda and stuff, like, even they were upset and sharing stories of things, like horror stories happened to them or their family members or their friends based on these shots. And it's really great timing, you know, because now they're coming out with, like, the fourth booster shot for everyone. And so hopefully they can at least avoid giving it to their children.
Yeah. Yeah. And now they're coming out with a new Omicron booster that's never been tested, just, you know, just a new one. No test, no human test at all, but
yeah.
Whatever.
They widely told the truth about that, too. Like, last time they tried to hide that they hadn't tested it on humans before. And this time they just came right out and said it.
Yeah, they did it. They did do them on humans. They just hid the results, according to RFK Jr.'s book. They, like, there was one story that he tells about a 12-year-old girl in a Pfizer study. And, you know, it was a small group of people or whatever, but, you know, she wanted to be in the trial, and she got it and ended up with, like, paralysis, like, has to be tube fed, just, like, really awful things. And Pfizer put it down as a stomach ache as a side effect.
Oh, wow.
You know, so they did the studies, but they didn't release the, you know, the data. They lied in their data. And that's why it's so important that that these Pfizer documents are coming out from the FDA. You heard of, it's been a while now, but you've heard about that case, right, where they I don't know what, I think it was a judge in Texas. They the funniest thing is that the FDA represented Pfizer, right? So our, you want to talk, you want to be upset about tax dollars being misspent? Our tax dollars pay for that. Our tax dollars paid, according to this system, paid for the FDA to pay their legal fees to represent Pfizer and hide behind wanting to keep the data that was turned over by Pfizer to the FDA that allowed, you know, them to make the decision to approve the emergency use authorization, right? So all of this data that they went over, all of the safety data that they went over supposedly to confirm that it was safe for humans, you know, we want to see all of that stuff. And then they say, oh, no, can't I, you know, we've got 75 years. We can probably maybe get it to you. But wait a second. You approved it in a month or what? Or what was it, 9 months? I don't even know how long from – you know, when it was, first submitted or first starting to be developed. It was warp speed after all. But, yeah, they did safety data, and it's all coming out now that all of these things that we were censored over, people are dying from it. People are being severely damaged. Their health is being severely damaged by these shots, and You know, so now I guess they're just going to circumvent all of that stuff and say, meh, yeah, we didn't really need to test it on people. So, you know, we don't really have safety data this time. Better prove it anyway, please.
Right. Well, and if we look at the animal studies even, you know, like all of the, they tried it on ferrets, they all died. They've been giving it to zoo animals, this COVID vaccine, and they're all having awful health problems and dying in record numbers. And it's really unfortunate, you know, because like sudden adult death syndrome is not a real thing. But the one thing that makes me happy about that being exposed now is that they will be forced. I don't see how they could not look at SIDS now and realize that that was all a vaccine injury that was causing that death, because now we have SADS, which, you know, I feel like if people have any type of brain function or spiritual connection whatsoever, they would realize that SADS is not a real thing. It has never existed before. But now, you know, it's one of the leading causes of death for people. And so that'll be really great. Like, maybe we can avoid, you know, like maiming and killing our children based on what the government tells us is safe and effective and good for them, you know?
At how many people are not vaccinating their children. You know, that to me is a very good sign that they're not really willing as a whole to subject their children to testing unnecessarily. You know, it also came out very recently that, speaking of testing, as part of the Pfizer data, that safety data that's been released already, we found out that, you know, out of 100 pregnant women who were part of these trials, 40% of them had spontaneous miscarriages. It's like, and then when we say they cause miscarriages, we get censored. We get banned. We're not allowed to say it. We get our YouTube channels deleted, you know? So it's, I think people are being forced to wake up to this. Like, this veil that we keep talking about, there's so many aspects of society that we just blindly said, oh, okay, all right, that's probably true. Took our doctor's words for it. We just, you know, went along to get along. And now all of a sudden, you know, they are questioning things like SIDS. I remember when I was having babies, I was very liberal. I was, you know, I voted for Obama, right? So
me too.
I was very liberal. And I believed in vaccines, and I believed all of these things. And, you know, I trusted these doctors. But something that still never really sat well with me, even when I was very liberal-minded, was that there is such a thing as sudden infant death syndrome. It's like the, you know, there's so many. Like, there's, you know, a shocking number of babies that are just dying for unknown reasons. And I'm like, we live in the best medical society in the world, you know? Why is it that this is happening in our country? And I didn't really connect it with vaccines until I connected autism with vaccines before I connected SIDS with vaccines, you know? And it was
right.
Very interesting, because are your children vaccinated?
Unfortunately, I was a bit of an idiot. And so they got all their, like, you know, the vaccine schedule that they get when they're babies and toddlers. And then, you know, I haven't given them any vaccines, like, further than that. And I got really lucky. But, you know, like, the last vaccine that my youngest daughter had, she broke out in hives and a rash that covered her entire body. They tried to tell me, it was, like, you know, within hours of the vaccine. And they tried to tell me that it was, you know, just a normal reaction. And then they tried to tell me it was a virus. And, you know, that was really a wake-up call for me. Like, we're never doing this again, ever. And that was several years ago. So I was really lucky. Like, I don't want to say lucky, but at the same time, it was lucky, you know, because then I just stopped all vaccinations for all of my daughters.
Yeah. That's awesome.
But, you know, it was a hard conversation that we had to have, where I had to sit them down and tell them, like, I am so sorry that I, you know, let you have these things and maybe harmed you with them, you know, because some things you don't know the impact, you know, for 20 years. But so I had to tell them, you know, like, I did this. I'm really sorry. This is why. Like, I thought it was the right thing to do. And I think it's important that we have conversations like that as parents, But it's also really hard, you know, to have to admit to yourself, let alone your children, that you may have done something harmful to them without realizing it.
Exactly. You know, and I understand that this is, you know, personal stories are anecdotal in a lot of people's minds. But my son, we did all the vaccines on schedule as baby and toddler. And around his 4 month shot, came home and immediately had a very, very high fever. You know, I think he had a rash. And I didn't even know at the time that it was the vaccine when that was happening. But it changed him, you know, and he's autistic. And my daughter, 2 years later, my mother-in-law was around at the time, ex-mother-in-law. And I was working like crazy, so she was in charge of taking Ava to go get vaccinated, right? And she insisted, she was, you know, a hippie, and she insisted that we break up the vaccines, right? So order them special, come in every month or whatever. For instance, like the MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, rubella, we would get a measles vaccine, a mumps vaccine, and a rubella vaccine. And this is, again, very anecdotal, but she's in seminars. She's in, you know, she's very, very bright, very, very capable. My son is very capable, too. He's very high-functioning autism, but he's autistic. And, you know, and that's something that I have to live with, that I did it. I was the one that bought the hype. I even remember asking my pediatrician, you know, that about what about this, you know, this autism is linked to vaccines. And he laughed and said that the guy who wrote that, because there was that Lancet, remember there was a Lancet article, research study published by a doctor in England that linked vaccines
right.
with autism. And he ended up floating in a river. You know what I mean? Like, they killed that dude, you know?
Yeah, they
killed
him. They killed him, and then they discredited all of his work very intentionally.
Yes, exactly. And so, you know, as I'm waking up to this vaccine issue, you know, there were also several others, still maybe anecdotal, but I know two other children who got shots in San Diego at the same clinic, and two of their babies both were, you know, two people in my close friend circle, they had epileptic, and one of them has Guillain-Barré syndrome. I mean, really, really messed up. And it's very strange to have a cluster of children all in the same city, you know, going to the same clinic, who have these very you know, severe reactions, and they believed it too. They believed that it was from vaccines. So
right, and that's just that's really a terrible thing. And I hope people will be, you know, like gentle with themselves, because yes, you know, like we made a choice that we shouldn't have made, but also, you know, I remember. Right, we trusted people that were supposed to know what they were doing and have our back and, you know, be working for our highest good and for the highest good of our children, you know, and, like, who would honestly imagine that somebody would go to medical school, you know, and become a pediatrician because they love children and then harm them? But the problem is that these doctors are not intentional. I don't think most of them intend to harm anybody. You know, I think that it is the fact that they're going to these Rockefeller, you know, indoctrination camps called schools, and they, Rockefellers own all of the medical schools everywhere. And so, you know, besides like the alternative ones. And so, you know, like these doctors, I don't think intend to do harm either, but they are only given the information by the Rockefellers. And if they question any of it, you know, they are threatened with being kicked out, with losing their license, you know, with prison. And so, you know, I was really young when I had Olivia. I was just turning 19, but I had asked because I didn't want to give her the vaccines, and I had like a weird reservation about it, and I didn't know why. I just felt like maybe we shouldn't be doing that. And I ended up doing it anyway, though, because I was told, you know, in no uncertain terms, like she won't be able to go to any daycares. She won't be able to go to any schools. she won't be able to participate in anything. And I didn't know about religious exemptions at that point, you know, and so I just went along. And I think that a lot of people do that because we want the best for our children, and we, you know, we don't want them to be excluded from everything. And
yeah,
I think it's why it's really important that this information is coming out now. And, you know, we have like 3 million more people homeschooling this year than last year, which is really positive.
That's a big win.
It's huge because, you know, if we can take our children out of these indoctrination centers, they can be more well-rounded, actual, you know, like real education. And I think it gives us a great opportunity to create some community homeschool programs to bridge the gap for families that, you know, feel like they can't homeschool, have concerns about it. You know, there's a lot of reasons why people don't homeschool, even though they would like to. And it's a great opportunity for us, I think, to bridge that gap and also provide more socialization, you know, for our children that are already in homeschool. So
right.
That's a big win.
Yeah.
Like, I'm really excited about that.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting because you guys probably still have religious exemptions. We don't. They took ours away for our children. And there's boosters that happen later in life, you know, for children that, you know, well, there's a few of them that are, you have to have them done in order to attend school. And the only real way to do it, to get around it, is to have a medical exemption, which my son has, fortunately. But, you know, it's very difficult here to avoid getting these shots. And even if you are in the know. But so that really the best way to do it is to homeschool because, or charter school. I'm really trying to keep my kids in this charter school because it's just part of a routine, and they do so well. Both of them are doing so good in this charter school. But they're pushing for vaccines, and public school is now pushing to get like HPV vaccines. And I'm not on the mandatory list, but they're heavily pushing the HPV vaccines for 12-year-old girls.
Yeah, they are. And it's really like that HPV vaccine especially is really gross, in my opinion. And the way that they advertise it too, like those, you know, those really gaslighting, guilt-tripping commercials where a child is asking their parent, like, why do I have cancer? Why didn't you give me this vaccine that could have prevented this cancer? And, you know, and then the parent, of course, is feeling guilty and explaining it and whatever. And it's really awful because there's no actual proof of these statistics that they throw out, you know, that all of these cancers are caused by HPV and that HPV just, you know, like spontaneously occurs randomly in people, which doesn't make any sense, you know. But then also, people have been for years now being paralyzed by that HPV vaccine, becoming sterilized, paralyzed, you know, all kinds of really horrible effects. People have died from it. And it's not small numbers of people. I mean, it's a significant enough number that even the mainstream media off and on has mentioned it. And to try to force something like that, you know, should show all of us as parents how diabolical these people truly are.
Yeah, absolutely. So back to the point of people are waking up, you know, I'm so encouraged by how parents have kind of, you know, just not complied, understand, not offer up their children to the, you know, to be sacrificed on the altar of, you know, big pharma, right? Understanding that
right.
They are guinea pigs at this point and wanting to protect their children from that really makes me hopeful. And the fact 2 million people have pulled out of traditional school, which is the reason if you want to stop people from going to school unnecessarily, that's the reason is because of the full court press in the indoctrination camps at school to get people to go to college. Nobody wants to talk about that. Nobody wants to talk
exactly.
about the fact that we had the same problem that I had, that we all have with the vaccines, right? That we trusted our doctor. We trusted our education system. And the education system basically was, you know, one step away from saying that you won't be happy in life if you don't go to college. college was very, very, very heavily pushed on our children, on my generation. I'm a millennial. You're a millennial, right?
Right. Well, and even my master's program that I'm in right now, you know, like I had to take a career counseling class last term, you know, and the entire focus of that was on going into fourth grade classrooms, eighth grade classrooms, then 11th grade classrooms to really heavily push 4-year colleges as the only option for them to be able to actually, you know, like make fiat later in life and be able to have the kind of life that they want. And it was an entire, you know, step-by-step program. And in fact, we had to attempt to write our own program of how we would cause that to occur. And, you know, it was the final project. Like, you can't pass the class or, you know, pass any of your masters if you don't do this, you know. And it was really difficult for me because I had to walk a really fine line, you know, of telling the truth and being authentic, but also, like, not being removed, which I find myself doing in every class. But especially this one, you know, that, like, we are supposed to tell children in fourth grade, you know, that they cannot do anything that they want to do in life unless they go and get this 4-year degree.
Yes. And that's, you know, another, like, reason. This is why this whole student loan topic is so icky, because it involves our children being, the product of these indoctrination centers. And that's the thing that nobody really wants to talk about. They don't want to talk about how our children are programmed to be in debt forever and to be, you know, reliant on the government forever, you know, and always one step away from poverty, never being able to own anything because you already basically have a mortgage in the form of a student loan payment. And so for those people who are like, you signed it, well, maybe there's a reason why somebody would sign such a predatory thing. Just like there's a reason that we, you know, that we vaccinated our children and not wanting to, right? So it's...
Exactly. You know, or why we realize that all of our food is poisoned, you know, and then we still consume some of it anyway because, you know, like it gets to a point, well, everything is poison. You know what I mean? And so at some point we just kind of make these little tiny concessions along the way that become bigger and bigger and bigger concessions.
Absolutely. So, you know, I don't know. Like, that's why this is so icky, is because they're basically blaming children. It would be like us saying, you know, sitting down with our children and explaining, you know, that you may have, that we put things in your body that shouldn't have been in there. Now we understand. It's basically like saying, well, it's your fault. To the kid, it's your fault you were sick. You know, it's your fault you got sick. That's what this is. That's what we're doing right now. And,
it's a huge form of gaslighting that we do to each other, and it doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So there's
and I
all
mean,
of
it's
these,
going
like,
to be dissolved anyway.
Exactly. Yes, there's all of these little, like, finite points that we're making to each other, not really, you know, realizing, or most of these people are not really realizing how close to the end of the U.S. dollar we are. You know, it's done. There's not really much that's going to save it. And student loan forgiveness is not the thing that pushed it over the edge. You know? It's such a bigger picture. And it's almost like they're putting their faith into the dollar, and they don't realize that the dollar is about to be nothing, right? So I don't
know. Exactly. They are holding on to ghosts, effectually. You know, they're holding on to these things that are not tangible, are not real. I'm not saying the ghosts aren't real, but, you know, they're holding on to things that are not physically tangible, that they cannot, you know, like, hold on to. And, in fact, it just makes them more stuck. I mean, I had this conversation a few years ago when I decided that I was going to do my master's program, and I decided to do it for a lot of reasons, but part of it was, you know, I don't want to participate in your society anymore, but I still have to pay bills, so I'll just live on my student loan for now and figure it out. and, you know, like not have to do like slave wage labor that I was doing before. And when they asked me, when the financial advisor asked me, how do you plan to pay your loans back? I said, I really honestly don't. I plan on everything collapsing before I would have to like really be too concerned about it. And she knew what was going on, you know, and she told me that there was really like nothing she could say to dissuade me from feeling that way because everything was collapsing and everything is an illusion. And these financial advisors, they know, you know, and you can have, I mean, I have conversations with them whenever they like credit collectors call me or, you know, like people from my financial situation with my student loans call me. We have conversations about the 13 bloodlines, about the dollar not being backed by anything, about the government being a corporation. Like, they all know, you know, and so
yeah.
It's very interesting to me because, like, the majority of people, I feel like, know that now and then just keep pretending like they don't know it, you know?
Exactly. Elizabeth is with us. She was listening for a while and just put her hand up. So hello, welcome.
Well, hey guys, you sound fantastic. I just jumped on because I'm loving this conversation. What do you think about the fact that this is the student loan forgiveness program was the very last Ponzi scheme that they had going that they wanted to continue? And not have that collapse like the housing crisis or the financial, you know.
Agreed.
Kind of triggered in my head there because I thought, you know, they made this into this is the new, let's get us all revved up and hating each other and fighting over nonsensical items. I can't believe how big of an issue it's become on the news and everywhere. But that just, I'm like, that could be an interesting little dynamic to this is that they don't want that to collapse because it has gotten where, you know, it's hard to get kids and parents to even buy into the college thing anymore because you have a whole generation, 10 years of people who have put a ton of money into education and they are not able to get these wonderful jobs that they all envisioned because of the economy and the job market, and they're in these entry-level jobs or no job at all. So how do we continue with this hamster wheel here? Well, let's just wipe the slate clean and we'll start all over again. And, you know, the one thing that they keep calling out is that this is going to only make – and this is almost like a put the little idea in their head so that they'll accept it. Because I'm watching the business channel is really talking about this. That the only thing this is really going to do is going to increase the tuitions of these schools are only going to go up higher. Therefore, you're not really helping anyone. You're hurting everyone. But here, now here's they're making it more, you know, for the people that want to buy into this fallacy that this will make your life all magically better. Now it's well worth the money because we can't have our college system can't collapse, you know, but it's crazy. It's really a crazy dichotomy. You know, when I was a kid, it wasn't even pushed like that. It was kind of like you were lucky. This is almost how they got the vaccine program, if you're lucky enough to get it, because we don't have enough of them. If you're lucky enough to get into college, if you're smart enough, that's when I started with all these tests. You had to pass the college entry level test to be able to be considered to go to college and not college material. And now that's something you never hear that. Everyone's college material. You know, it's like breathing. You have to continue with your education, which is.
So we have a caller, been on the show before, Joanne, and I know her personally. She's got some thoughts on this subject. So
I love Joanne. I was hoping she'd call
awesome.
In.
Awesome.
Yay!
I just talked for a second because I'm – yes, well, I might pop back out because I do have a headache. And thank you for picking up the slack. You guys are
sorry.
Doing a good job. It's okay. Thanks a lot, Lily. Well, Joanne, welcome. Thank you.
Oh,
welcome
thanks. I
I love participating when the time allows.
Yay. Okay, so you have some thoughts on basically on these subjects. So you wanted to take the floor?
Sure. When I was on, either the last time or the time before that, I was very adamant about having parents be a proponent of, rather than pointing the finger out there to the fake powers that be that are making their children wear masks, that rather the parent had the opportunity to claim their divine authority as the one that's determining the well-being of their child, and to just act in authority filled with the Holy Spirit, because that really then takes everyone else out of the game. You just are then in complete control and divine power over how you make your life look. Of course, people will have their, it's hard though because, and then they come up with all of their reasons. And that's really just the devil using the mask of doubt to sit on your shoulder that you can't usually identify as the devil, because doubt is such a soft, soft version of the devil. So in parlaying, that was like my place of where I come from, is to come out of this, funhouse of mirrors where all of this polarity and duality and the fighting continues because we feed it by pointing the finger. And yes, there are these folks that are in these positions that are really doing not nice things. That is true. But when we point the finger, there are still invariably three fingers pointing back at us. And we have the, real opportunity, the real invitation to have extreme accountability in that. And that's where power comes from, is when you're willing to be accountable of what your own actions are in the scheme of things. So I'm going to go to a verse. I'd always been really curious about how much attention is given to, especially in these times of the last 2.5 years, about Jesus at the temple. It's Matthew 21, Matthew 21, 12 through, it looks like, 13. And it says, Jesus entered the temple courts and drove out all who were buying and selling there. I'm going to go back after I read through this, and I'm going to share the etymology of the word selling. It's really, really important because we take it at face value rather than looking at historical definitions. Okay. He overturned the tables of the money changers. Usually what people are talking about online, they have these memes where Jesus went in and the money changers are the bankers. And so we have this whole, like, woe is me, these bad guys over there pointing the finger, talking about the bankers and how corrupt they are. It's true. They are corrupt. I'm not invalidating that. I'm a former banker. I'm a former retirement specialist. I have paid my dues and my repentance in having been brainwashed by the system of being part of the shenanigans. But furthermore, the verse continues, and it says, so he overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves. What does dove represent in the Bible? I'm pretty sure most people know that the dove represents peace. So again, the word selling shows up. When words are repeated in verses, there is major, major importance. There's a reason for the repetition. It's not by happenstance. So in this verse, literally this one verse, the word selling is mentioned twice. All right, and it says, it is written, he said to them, my house will be called a house of prayer, but you are making it a den of robbers. I just highly encourage anyone to pray on this, meditate on this, whatever your spiritual practice is, because if what I'm saying to you today doesn't resonate, there can just be a trigger that's happening. And the trigger is your opportunity to have something revealed from your soul, of a shadow of where you're lacking responsibility. Okay, so the word selling, let me go to the etymology page here. Okay, so you can, this whole thing about like looking at the historical definitions of words is so, so helpful when you're reading Bible verses and also when you're reading like legal things and, you know, just all the stuff that's coming out and through the news, like knowing the etymology of these words is helpful, because then you'll start to notice that our language has been changed with intention in order to deceive us so that we live in an inverted society. Okay, so the word cell, Middle English, cellen, from Old English cellen, to give something to someone, furnish, supply, lend, surrender, give up, deliver to, promise, offer up, deliver, to hand over, deliver cell, to give, hand over cell, to offer a sacrifice, and to take grasp. There was something else. I apologize. I screenshot it and now I've lost it. Oh, here we go. A little further down in the definition. The meaning, betray for gain. So the idea of selling is to betray one for your own gaining. And we have all been by money. Money has been used in such a way for God only knows how long, because I don't know. I wasn't there personally. But God knows how long that it has been there to be used specifically as an energy for betrayal. Now, I'm not trying to say that folks got to go back all the way to like a barter system. What I do know, though, is the more that we look at the situation with money, the more that we stay in a made-up mind control matrix that is all about manipulation and betrayal. And folks laugh at me when I share this, but we are, in our lifetime, we will witness where we all trust one another because our souls are evolving, that we will give and share with our neighbor and share with our family and share with strangers, that we will just give wholly from our heart whatever our capacity is to give. And we won't be doing this transactional, well, I gave you 3 loaves of bread, so then you've got to babysit my kid for 2 hours. It won't be transactional. Everyone will simply participate, and everyone will be led to the person or sentient being, I like to say, because person has such a weird legal definition, where someone is going to be able to provide for you when you have something that you need. And it's all going to be a very open, caring, true soul community that we live in. And it is going to happen in our lifetime. And this is how come people keep referring to Revelation and how, you know, in the end of Revelation, it says all is well. People seem to forget that. Yes, there's going to be, you know, stuff that happens that kind of shakes people, but it's not going to be God-awful. It's going to be divine.
Amen.
I like that. You know, it's very cool how you put the definition. And what stuck out in my head was to give, what was it? To give, I can't remember. But, you know, back to the reason that there were money changers in the temple was in order for them to be cleansed, they needed to perform a sacrifice. And because they had traveled so far, they didn't want to have to lug around, you know, a lamb with them or a chicken or whatever they used. And they were selling items in the temple for them to buy or to perform their sacrifice to cleanse their temple. And it's so apropos that Jesus overturned it all because he was the patient. His sacrifice did away with all of that. And
correct.
You know, and what was the last, one of the last definitions of the etymology was
the last on that was right there. Betray for gain.
Yeah. And yes, exactly. And that's exactly what he did away with. And, you know, everything that we actually need has been given to us. So if we were to go back to just living lovingly and without holding back, you know, sharing and knowing that your cup will be filled, will continue to be filled up if you are a generous person and everything here is provided for us. And we did away with all this selfishness and you know, tit for tat, you can't have anything unless there's something in it for me. The wheel of the circle of life, per se, would just flow naturally.
It would.
And
yes, exactly.
I think
that.
Eventually it will actually kind of go back to how it should have been without the greed and the selfishness and that spirit of the world, so to speak. That was very good. I liked it. Thank you.
I'm loving this conversation.
Mm-hmm. The main reason why I had gone to look it up with the selling of doves is because there are a lot of, sadly, it makes me really sad to say this, and I won't name any names, and yet everyone's heard them talk, and there's so many that are in the alternative media space with everything that's happened since the pandemic began, but the selling of doves, right? So Jesus flipped their tables too, because they are betraying for gain the idea of peace. There's a lot of people who are profiting off of this idea to steer the ship in a specific way so that
mm-hmm.
peace comes. And it's
mm-hmm.
I don't think they even know that they are acting in an inverted way, but they have not yet cleansed that part of themselves to truly give of their heart. If they want to be in the space of having divine truth, like you would just do it like how a mother takes care of her children. A mother has never demanded payment for taking care of her children.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's a great point. I love you so much, Joanna. I'm so excited that you're here.
Aw, thanks.
So I also now that we're on the Bible, I guess it's always about the Bible, but I do have, I want to play up one audio about Jubilee and what it says in the Bible.
Oh, cool. I'm glad you didn't do that yet. You know, I thought that was very apropos for the conversation of the debt forgiveness controversy that was going on. Because that the Jubilee even transferred into working life, even like in the 1800s when you had indentured servants, they were given the opportunity every 7 years to buy back their bond, so to speak, if they had enough money. And if they didn't, then you had to wait another 7 years, but you were not like perpetually indebted to be an indentured servant was kind of like a slave that you could buy your way out of it. Kind of like, almost like, like an apprentice program kind of thing.
Indentured servant is what it is.
Indentured, yes, exactly. So that, the Jubilee is really cool. So I think a lot of people will get a lot out of it, because that's something that really isn't talked about in a lot of churches. It's an older type of thing that I don't think I've heard in years, actually. So I think it's a wonderful thing to get into.
Okay.
If
all right,
I can
cool.
piggyback
all right.
off of what you said regarding the Jubilee and mentioning the 7 years, not everyone necessarily knows this, but apparently, and I'm doing this based on hearsay, I have read and been told that our whole body, all of our cells, is like a brand new being every 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
Like you don't have
mm-hmm.
any cells that are the same cells from 7 years ago. You're brand new. And that's one of the reasons how come bankruptcy can only stay on your credit report for 7 years, because and then people can go and file bankruptcy again, because you're actually a whole brand new being. It's not the same being that's in front of the judge. It's a brand new being, and so they have to allow you to do it.
That is pretty
that's
cool.
That's amazing. More people need to realize that doesn't always define them, and they're, you know, they have an opportunity in so many ways to be a whole new person in regular intervals. So, you know, biblical numerology is a really interesting subject. And Joanne, you kind of talked a little bit about, like, if things are done twice, that means actually in biblical numerology, it means proven, right? 7 years is perfection, mm-hmm. right? So there's all mm-hmm. of these six is human, right? That's why 666 mm-hmm. is complete, you know, or three is complete. So 666 is complete right. human, no soul, no spirit, right? So so anyway, but let's I'm actually just going to, I found a clip of a reading of the Leviticus Jubilee chapter or verses. So let's just listen to that, you know, in, you know, as it was written, and then we'll discuss after, okay?
Sounds great.
Count off 7 Sabbath years, 7 times 7 years, so that the 7 Sabbath years amount to a period of 49 years. Then have the trumpet sounded everywhere on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement sound the trumpet throughout your land. Consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you, each of you is to return to your family property and to your own clan. The 50th year shall be a jubilee for you, do not sow and do not reap what grows of itself or harvest the untended vines. For it is a jubilee and is to be holy for you, eat only what is taken directly from the fields. In this year of jubilee everyone is to return to their own property. If you sell land to any of your own people or buy land from them, do not take advantage of each other. You are to buy from your own people on the basis of the number of years since the jubilee, and they are to sell to you on the basis of the number of years left for harvesting crops. When the years are many, you are to increase the price, and when the years are few, you are to decrease the price. Because what is really being sold to you is the number of crops. Do not take advantage of each other, but fear your God. I am the Lord your God. Follow my decrees and be careful to obey my laws, and you will live safely in the land. Then the land will yield its fruit, and you will eat your fill and live there in safety. You may ask, what will we eat in the 7th year if we do not plant or harvest our crops? I will send you such a blessing in the 6th year that the land will yield enough for 3 years. While you plant during the 8th year, you will eat from the old crop and will continue to eat from it until the harvest of the 9th year comes in. The land must not be sold permanently, because the land is mine and you reside in my land as foreigners and strangers. Throughout the land that you hold as a possession, you must provide for the redemption of the land. If one of your fellow Israelites becomes poor and sells some of their property, their nearest relative is to come and redeem what they have sold. If, however, there is no one to redeem it for them but later on they prosper and acquire sufficient means to redeem it themselves, they are to determine the value for the year since they sold it and refund the balance to the one to whom they sold it, they can then go back to their own property. But if they do not acquire the means to repay, what was sold will remain in the possession of the buyer until the year of Jubilee. It will be returned in the Jubilee, and they can then go back to their property. Anyone who sells a house in a walled city retains the right of redemption a full year after its sale. During that time the seller may redeem it. If it is not redeemed before a full year has passed, the house in the walled city shall belong permanently to the buyer and the buyer's descendants. It is not to be returned in the Jubilee. But houses and villages without walls around them are to be considered as belonging to the open country. They can be redeemed, and they are to be returned in the Jubilee. The Levites always have the right to redeem their houses in the Levitical towns, which they possess. So the property of the Levites is redeemable, that is, a house sold in any town they hold, and is to be returned in the Jubilee, because the houses in the towns of the Levites are their property among the Israelites. But the pasture land belonging to their towns must not be sold, it is their permanent possession. If any of your fellow Israelites become poor and are unable to support themselves among you, help them as you would a foreigner and stranger, so they can continue to live among you. Do not take interest or any profit from them, but fear your God, so that they may continue to live among you. You must not lend them money at interest or sell them food at a profit. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. If any of your fellow Israelites become poor and sell themselves to you, do not make them work as slaves. They are to be treated as hired workers or temporary residents among you, they are to work for you until the year of Jubilee. Then they and their children are to be released, and they will go back to their own clans and to the property of their ancestors. Because the Israelites are my servants, whom I brought out of Egypt, they must not be sold as slaves. Do not rule over them ruthlessly, but fear your God. Your male and female slaves are to come from the nations around you. From them you may buy slaves. You may also buy some of the temporary residents living among you and members of their clans born in your country, and they will become your property. You can bequeath them to your children as inherited property and can make them slaves for life, but you must not rule over your fellow Israelites ruthlessly. If a foreigner residing among you becomes rich and any of your fellow Israelites become poor and sell themselves to the foreigner or to a member of the foreigner's clan, they retain the right of redemption after they have sold themselves. One of their relatives may redeem them, an uncle or a cousin or any blood relative in their clan may redeem them. Or if they prosper, they may redeem themselves. They and their buyer are to count the time from the year they sold themselves up to the year of Jubilee. The price for their release is to be based on the rate paid to a hired worker for that number of years. If many years remain, they must pay for their redemption a larger share of the price paid for them. If only a few years remain until the year of Jubilee, they are to compute that and pay for their redemption accordingly. They are to be treated as workers hired from year to year. You must see to it that those to whom they owe service do not rule over them ruthlessly. Even if someone is not redeemed in any of these ways, they and their children are to be released in the year of Jubilee, for the Israelites belong to me as servants. They are my servants, whom I brought out of Egypt. I am the Lord your God.
Okay, so now that I know that was a lot, and there's a lot of things in there that don't, you know, that we don't really do anymore, although we do. I mean, people don't want to realize that they're slaves, but we are.
Well, it really is. If you sell yourself. Oh, go ahead. Thinking about how we sell ourselves into slavery. Every time you like, I'm about to refinance my car and throw my credit cards into it. You just accrue debt, right? And then you're like, oh my God, I got to consolidate everything. I can't afford it. Get a couple weeks off of paying, and then collectively, you know, you have to continually go to that rotten job you hate, and you've given yourself 5 years, 6 years of servitude to pay off this debt. We do this all the time, mortgages, whatever. It's amazing.
Now, I think what's going on, though, is that, you know, and not to invalidate these laws, right, because that's not something that as a Christian we can really invalidate. You know, we can say that was forgiven or, you know, things like that. But, you know, to invalidate why this was ever good is noteworthy. Now, I think what we're doing right now is going from a time where these laws may have been more necessary to a place of ascension, where we're not going to need to abide, you know, abide by laws that, you know, that have currency attached to them, right? So I think that's what this ascension is really all about, is getting to a place like, you know, like what Joanne is talking about, that, you know, we don't have to rely on a currency to keep, you know, for us to thrive, right? We can all give what we can and allow for the divine to provide for us with our labors.
May I ask a question? Because I am not a biblical scholar. I'm just led to read, you know, certain chapters out of books as like they come into my awareness for whatever message I'm supposed to share. Is the book of Leviticus, is it in the Old Testament?
Yes. Yeah, it is the law.
Okay, I had a feeling. I had a feeling. And so in my comprehension, and I could be wrong, but in my comprehension from what I've ascertained out of lots and lots of listening to people who know more than me about ascension and the Bible and how it does all relate, is that Jesus was the one to bring in the age of Pisces. And so, like, the Old Testament, well, sure, like, every time we move from, that would have been, what comes before Pisces? I guess that would have been the age of Aries. And then we're, like, on our way now, like, we're in this transition. No one wants to claim to know exactly when the age of Aquarius started or is starting. There's a lot of controversy on that, and I'm not attached to it. And what was I going to say? Oh, well, so Jesus was the one to bring in the age of Pisces. And so whenever we're changing of these ages, we take the good with us and we discard what didn't work, because it's always a growing, just like a farmer or gardener would do, is they would like look at what they've planted and what they harvested, and they would make changes based on what they observed.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, something that we've completely lost sight of is the seven-year thing, that the everything, you know, death can only be held for 7 years. And, you know, that's something that the Bible backs up. Now, slavery, you know, I don't know. I think that we have evolved to a point where most of us first understand that slavery doesn't necessarily mean bondage, right? If you, there's all kinds mm-hmm. of different, you know, forms of slavery. So, and also the fact that it's said over and over again that if you do own slaves, you have to be, nice to them. You have to treat them, and, mm-hmm. you know, provide an environment to these people where they can thrive. You know, and as Revelation, it's funny, it's called Revelation, right? Because that's what's going on, is everybody, the masses are starting to wake up to a lot of things. A lot of things are being revealed that, and I don't think that there's going to be long until people realize that we are slaves to this system. And as soon as they do, because they believe they're free right now. And as things are revealed, they're going to walk away from the system and ascend, I believe.
And nobody can stop them. Even the Bible, because even these people that play in these positions of the fake powers, even they have an honoring of what God's law is. So they won't. So as people opt out, they really don't stop you. It's just your own. It's your own free will choice to opt out.
Exactly. Yep, I totally agree. Any thoughts?
Well, I think that that's what we are moving into, as this revelation, or, you know, revealing of the truth becomes more widely accepted and known. You know, like, we are moving into our sovereign state of being, into natural law, you know, where we no longer require any rulers, because we are then able to rule ourselves under the tenets of natural law. And then I think we will return back to, you know, like the Garden of Eden, so to speak, of living the way that we were always intended to live, the ways of our ancestors, while utilizing new things that we've learned that didn't work for them, you know, like we will still go back to living in a harmonious relationship with each other and with the land itself.
Totally
and it's
agree.
Interesting because our indigenous prophecies really like match up. I mean, it's not... like, it's not surprising, you know, but I think it's really beautiful the ways in which all the spiritual texts all relate to each other and say the same thing, just in, like, a slightly different way. And the same thing with all of our indigenous prophecies. You know, they all talk about this age that we are in now, where the truths are revealed and people return back to each other the way that they were supposed to. Like, we complete the medicine wheel because, according to, like, you know, several, like the Anishinaabe and Lakota, Hopi, all of these different tribes, we were created together as, you know, like the nations of the medicine wheel. And then we were sent away from each other to focus on different things and learn different things. And we were supposed to return back and share everything that we had learned for this age. And then we got separated and we forgot and we warred against each other. And so now, you know, like in this, they're called different things, the Black Snake Prophecy, the Prophecy of the Eighth Fire, the Fifth Earth of the Hopi, but it's all the same thing, you know, like where we come back to each other, unite, reform the sacred circle of the medicine wheel, and then live that way in harmony with each other for several ages.
And then I'm glad, Joanne, I'm glad you brought up the ages, right? Ages of Pisces, right? Is that because speaking of this divide, I really do think like there, you know, there's a big divide between like Muslims and Jews, right? Like, and Christians, but they, like the first Muslim and the first Jewish person, you know, both came, the came from this, literally the same father, Abraham, right? And so, you know, and how did you know, Abraham know he was going to be the father of many nations? Well, he read it in the stars, right? So it's really, to me, very comforting to know that there are scriptures basically written in the stars as well as on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how, you know, people who have never read a Bible, never, you know, understood these words, still have this, you know, this way of coming together and believing the same things at the end of the day. This man-made divide that's been successfully ruling the people is cracking. It's crumbling. And I think that's, I am very hopeful because the fact that we see it in so many different ways, all of the tomes come together and say the same thing, that we are on the right track by, you know, by knowing that this is going to be the time of change. How do we know in our lifetime and people, you know, hundreds of years ago didn't, you know, that's, we all know that things are changing and it's you know, an ascension is upon us.
Mm-hmm. Amen. What I relate to when people have these conversations online about, like, oh, New Age, oh, like, your stuff from indigenous cultures doesn't apply because we've evolved to this, like, you know, age of Christianity. And then I'm like, guys, that's still just division and polarity. And do you not think the divine creator, God, would, as us being his children, every single one of us, would not learn a way to deliver the message, even if he has to tweak the message to fit so that you can comprehend it? So he speaks all the languages. He speaks in whatever parable, whatever story, like, is going to help someone to find their unique path to him. Yes.
Yeah. So I'm excited to be here and helping people through it and helping myself through it too. It's not, I mean, no, none of us are perfect, right? So we still have our things that we have to figure out and let go of and things like that. But, you know, it's very apparent that that I think we're all here for a reason, and I'm up for the challenge. It's like, that's why I don't have a problem saying the gospel according to Lily or Joanne or whatever, because I really do believe that, you know, these strong women in history are going to be written about for the next generation. Proud to know all of you and to know that we're all on the same journey of you know, of what God's plan is for us in the grand scheme of this ascension.
Yeah. Based on you saying that, I just have to point to the Book of Esther, because it's just one of the few books in the Bible that's literally named after a woman's, quote, name. So some people look at it like as, you know, very literal. And I've always said, well, God is so amazing. Like, it's all historically true and literal. And it's also very much like a parable as it applies to what your life looks like right now and what you can, you know, gain from it in your own reality now. The Book of Esther, though, when you take those letters and you, how do you say that? Is it an anagram? Is that what it is when you switch up the letters and it makes another word? Anagram?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, anagram. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's ethers. And ethers, right, like when people receive, like, their inner God voice, it comes through the ethers. Sometimes that is like a friend of yours speaking something and, like, you pick up on this one gem that they said. Sometimes you're reading the Bible and that's the ethers. Like, it's everything that's around us, like the quantum physics. It's everything that's around us is the ethers. And so, like, it's thought that Esther, not only having been a woman that walked the earth, but also, like, her continuation in the ethers and what she did, the very big thing that she called to have people do was to fast. And I'm always reminded, fasting is not only about food. So if people have a hard time with, like, doing a food fast, take a, you know, electronic device fast, take a, you know, take 3 days off from driving, like, any kind of a fast that you commit yourself to is a fast. and it will spiritually up-level you.
That's a beautiful reminder that it's not just food.
You're cleansing yourself, cleansing your whole spirit and body and mind when you're fasting. It's essential. That is the most integral thing that you could do.
Mm-hmm.
In my opinion, I agree. I love your ideas, Joanna. Wonderful.
Nah, thanks. Well, I know because I talk to a wide variety of people, and I know for some it's just like they can't even fathom the thought of not eating for 3 days. Like it's just not comprehensible to them. But the taking a 3-day break from technology, like they know they've done it in the past, they could purposefully do it again. So, and you know, maybe they can only do a 24-hour fast. You know, it all matters. It all helps.
Absolutely. Yeah, and if you look at it as detoxifying your system, detoxifying your psyche. You know, if you even just stop watching the news and watch, you know, happy things or went out, you know, detoxify from society per se and go out in nature. Some call it
right. There's so many poisons that we, you know, subject ourselves to on a daily basis.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily have to be a poison that you ingest, right? There's, you know, like news is a really good one for people who still watch the news that, you know, take a week off. You know, like I love watching, just rewatching old Downton Abbey episodes, right? So, because it's just, you know, so like the scenery is beautiful. It's, you know, there's not really big world problems. You know, I mean, even that is something that, you know, just to get your mind off of this constant fear place. So, what kind of poison is that? You know, do we subject ourselves to on a daily basis if we still watch the news?
Exactly. I was thinking, I had to chuckle because I'm like, oh, let's not say it, but dare say it. Will we have a jubilee from COVID? Because we're like going on the fourth year here. but, you know, jubilee, you know, we're done. Oh gosh!
Every seventh year, they take off their mask and they skip vaccines for a year and they.
Oh god! We'll tell a story about how it used to be the time before.
No,
we're not doing that. But
that's the thing.
Yes, I think we need to bring back the jubilee. Even on
Absolutely.
A
that. Well, for prison, too, because they talk about imprisonment. Like, people, you can't have prison sentences longer than 7 years. However, back then, it's like capital punishment was not a big, they were, you know, a big deal. They cut your hand off. They pluck out your eye. They, you know, they do a lot of things that, you know, so if the crime is that egregious, right, they would probably just kill you, right? So that's why they say everything else can be forgiven, and you know, a 7-year imprisonment is long enough for any other infraction other than the infractions that you die for. So, that's why, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So people who molest children, I'm okay with them not being eligible for the 7 years. You know, things like that. There are things that we could be doing immediately that the Bible. That the Bible dictates, like gleaning, right, in fields. We should, Levitical laws is, you know, if you've got, a grove of oranges and a wind comes and knocks off, you know, 10% of your crop, you can't pick it up and sell it. You have to let people go in and eat it, because that's from God. God did that, you know. So there are and shellfish, right? Like, there's all kinds of good laws that we could do, re-implement.
Well, yeah, and there was a X amount of feet on the edge of your field that was designated for others to have. That was the extra crop, I believe, that they had that allocated as the form of love thy neighbor, and that was like their form of social net that was there for their welfare was there was food provided for those who didn't have, and that was just part of how farmers farmed, because they took care. They had that in the forefront of their mind that we did take care of each other. And if you look at, like, the Lord's Prayer, you know, all of those tenets are in there. You know, you forgive your trespasses and provide for others. And it's something that's long past coming back into becoming popular and fashionable to be a good person again.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, even here's a fun fact. Okay, so the Ten Commandments, right? One of them is do not covet your neighbor's.
Uh-huh.
That is it, because, you know, homie rolls up in his Corolla and his neighbor has a Lamborghini. That's not how it worked. Everything was so, evenly divided back then, that if you're coveting your neighbor's property, that means that you're trying to take something. Like, let's say you've got a chicken and he's got a chicken. If you want to steal your neighbor's chicken, mm-hmm. you've got two chickens now mm-hmm. and he's got nothing. Right. So that's,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, it's very interesting how, if we applied these things, we'd probably be in a much, much better position as a society.
Absolutely.
I was trying to look for it, because you mentioned, Danielle, about, I'm okay with these pedophiles not being forgiven, and let's go ahead and just, like, you know, end their life and have them wherever they end up. I don't know what that final destination is. But it is referenced in the Bible, and I came across it in 2020. I'm trying to look for it and not finding it, but it says that God, if you are asking for forgiveness, God will forgive all missings of the mark, all sins. Because in his eyes, they're really all equal except for one, and is the harm of stealing innocence from children.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, there's a quote from the Bible. I don't know what verse, but it says that if you harm children, you should rather have a millstone tied around your neck and be thrown into the sea, you know, because what he will do to you is infinitely worse than that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I just want to say that they had, you know, along with an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, they had immediate punishments for those, just like the thief would have his right hand cut off, and if he did it again, the left hand. I don't think that they went very far if they were caught doing something, like they were immediately taken care of. Point of fact, the eunuch, I think there was a lot of eunuchs. That was a surefire way of becoming a eunuch. They would have immediate castration. I'm thinking that was perhaps the punishment for that, if you go back and look. I'm thinking.
Yeah. So throughout our, you know, it's always been that we respect our elders and we protect our children. And somehow, you know, now we've invalidated our elders and we're offering up our children to pedophiles left and right, you know.
How did we get where we are? Yeah. How did we get where we are? And it made me think, your wonderful prophecies and essence of what you were speaking, that we're coming to a point where humanity is going to collectively come together. It's almost like how is that going to happen? Because we've gotten to such a degraded point where we're at right now, where it's like, oh my gosh, no. We can't do this. We have to go in a different direction. I think that might be what's happening, is like the shock value of how insane and obscene this is, that people are going to, you know, reflect away from that. And it's like, we're going in another direction. Sorry, we're not doing this. Because it is getting to be so horribly painful to see what direction they want us to be in, if that makes sense to you.
Oh, right. Yeah, right. Well, in the Catholic Church, like, I really do think that part of the biggest reason that the Catholic Church attracts so many pedophiles is because they opposed what the Bible said to do when forming a church. So it's in Timothy, they talk about how if you're going to be the head of a church, you have to be, there's all these things, sober, virtuous. There's translations that say the husband of at least one wife, and husband of one wife. But marriage is definitely a part of it, because basically if you can't run a household, how are you going to be at the center of a community, right? So, but what happened was when the, you know, the churches were getting set up way back in the day, the church had land, had to be Vatican land, had to be in the name of the priest. Now they were able to marry back then. But what was happening, you know, because, and the rationale for that is that, every, you know, you don't need, it would take too long to write to the Vatican every time you needed to get a fence fixed and get his approval, right? There's months and months to do that. So church property in the name of the priest who's married and having children. So they're, you know, having children and then dying and willing church property off to their family. And so the church is taking a financial hit. So they're like, you're married to Jesus now. And so I think that that bastardization of what the of what God has set aside for churches is the reason that there's this perversion so deep inside of it. I think that's part of it.
That's interesting. That's something to research.
I'm not, obviously, I'm not saying all Catholics are bad, you know. I'm not even saying that all priests are bad. But, you know, it, that we do need to realize what causes these things. They don't just magically appear.
Exactly. And they certainly did make a recipe for disaster when you take away that natural, everyone was born with a desire to have sex. And then they just said, no, sorry, you can't have it. And that was a breeding ground for many other terrible things to transpire. And it'd be interesting to see exactly what their rationale, what their code of this is why we say. Because it is a split in
money.
The church, too. There are some. Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. The money is the root of all evil. Yes.
Right. And that's why, like, I would never go to the Vatican, even if I was, like, in Europe and, you know, that's just as a beautiful city or whatever. Like, I don't, you know, I'm pretty sure that Jesus didn't have, you know, ruby encrusted walls in mind when he wanted to form a church, right?
Well, no. Wonderful case in point was the beginning of this conversation was when he went into the temple and chased out the money makers.
Right.
Yeah, that was not what he wanted.
Because I think we all have to. I mean, I don't think enough people draw the connection between banks and government and church back then either. Because the Pharisees were basically the rulers back then, the head of the temple.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it was all that was the government at the time. Were those people.
Yes.
So people don't draw enough parallels to the fact that Jesus basically went in and told off the government for doing it wrong. And why more people aren't doing that to ours is beyond me.
Well,
and even the inversion of the Vatican ruling, you know, I mean, their symbol literally is the upside down cross, which, you know, is a symbol of inversion, that they have inverted everything to make it upside down.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And back to the symbols. Joanne, I thought it was fascinating when you were talking about the year of Pisces and the fish. And that's become a big symbol. You see a lot of people who have the fish on their car because they're a Christian. I'd like to know more about the astrology and that symbolism, if you have a little more info. Because I find that very fascinating.
I read a lot of different things, and what I know is I don't have to look at a lot of things like in depth. So sometimes people have questions and I don't have like all the answers. But what I do know about Pisces is it relates to like each of the different signs in our birth natal chart would everyone has all the planets and everyone has all the signs. And it just helps you to know like the 12 rooms of your house of, you know, the temple that God has given to you has a different way of how it shows up in your life. And the Pisces, there's two
things that like mirror each other in the symbol in astrology, and it correlates to our feet, which we talk about, you know, people say like the soles of your feet. And so it, in my perception, what I've gleaned from it is we're doing a deep cleansing of our soul during the age of Pisces for our ascension. And it all has to do with like, you know, the soles of our feet get dirty, and we are meant to touch the earth with our feet. And that's the dirt that God wants us to be getting our souls dirty with, but not like our soul being dirty with all these fake powers that be. And you know how they used to, I don't know that they necessarily do this all the time, but they used to take babies' feet prints when they would put them on a kind of like a make-believe birth certificate, right? It was kind of like a totem gift that they would give you when you birthed in the hospital. Yeah, and that was just part of their, foul work. I don't know if they still do it. Yeah. So, yeah, it's really fascinating when you do listen to folks that know mythology really well and, know more of how these different signs and their symbolism to the body, and how, of course, these entities that wanted to corrupt everything, like, twisted it.
And always have, yeah. We had a guest on a long time ago, Sabrina, who has a really interesting theory that the Garden of Eden and the forbidden fruit was the first time that the first takeover of our food. Right, that was like the metaphor there was the first, and that's something that I've been kind of chewing on for a while now, that was the sin that got them kicked out, was participating in a system like, you know, that takes advantage of people by their food, controls them by food.
Yeah, so fascinating. That makes a lot of sense. That really resonates.
Yeah. So, and of course, that's why, you know, another reason it's one of the first resources we have to take back from this system is our food, because there's so many things attached to it, right? There's so many ways that they control us by the poisons that they put in it, through the price they put on it, through the false scarcity they get us to believe in, that it seems to be, pun intended, low-hanging fruit, that's the first thing we take back. Because it might have been the first thing to enslave us.
It 100% gave me the angel bump when you said it. So I would have to, like, claim that as being truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is interesting. Go ahead.
It is interesting that you're mentioning, you know, the whole thing about the fruit and the Garden of Eden, and there's different perceptions on some people say that it was an apple, but I don't know the absolute truth on this, but I've been looking at it recently, and it felt in resonance that I guess I want to say Hebrew, and sometimes I do get this wrong because I just read so much stuff, whether it was Hebrew or Greek, or maybe it was even the Aramaic language, that when it's translated from like the oldest, how it was written for the Old Testament, it doesn't say apple, it just says fruit. And then, as one like looks at that entire first few chapters of Genesis, that they could ascertain the shame that was felt by Adam and Eve. What did they do? They covered themselves with fig leaves. Okay, well, how come fig leaves? Like, I feel like as I'm speaking it, literally this is just coming in. It's not like this part was there before. That whole buyers and sellers thing that I mentioned with that Matthew 21. In fact, I'm going to pull it up again so that we can, because it's just so powerful and it really relates to this, and it's just all coming together perfectly in this conversation. I love that. So the fig leaves, like, why was that picked? Well, because that was the fruit that they, and
and you know, I'm sure there's more that could be figured out with that. And I did do an etymology on fig, and I don't have it handy, but let's just see if I can pull back up the Matthew 21 verse 12.
It is Hebrew, by the way. Everything in the Old Testament is Hebrew, and the New Testament is half Greek and half Aramaic.
Oh, okay. Okay, so the Old Testament, Hebrew. Okay, got it. That's helpful. Thank you so much. Let's see. Let me go back to the right. Okay, so Matthew 21, verse 12. Jesus entered the temple courts and drove out all who were buying and selling there. So our opportunity to remember here is he wasn't just mad at the sellers. He was mad at the buyers, too, because the sellers can't sell nothing if we don't buy.
Good point.
We have to have extreme accountability to not be buyers of it.
Totally agree.
Yeah.
Wow.
Earlier when I was talking about that, I forgot to circle back about, you know, tying in together the whole, like, we point at the government and we point at the pharmaceuticals and we point at the media, and just like, just remember, like, your opportunity is just to, it's literally said so clearly. He wasn't just mad at the money changers. He wasn't just mad at the people being the false idols of selling peace. He wasn't just mad at the sellers, these merchants and, you know, tax collectors. He was also mad at the buyers.
Absolutely. Yeah. Wonderful point. Wonderful point. Because if they did not comply, the whole system would have fallen down. It wouldn't have been there.
Correct. So everyone, you know, our invitation really is, like, let's just stop finger pointing. Let's just be like, okay, I know that there's this, like, you know, that there's layers to moving ourselves out of these structures, and it's okay. Like, just take baby steps. Like, you know, like, I didn't renew my California DMV driver's license last year. It just so happened that somebody stole the license plates off of my car, and I did not replace them. I was like, oh, I guess God wants me to be a bigger example.
To be sovereign.
Yeah,
I guess. Follow the Constitution. Yeah. I really like this. I'm going to look up. You're on to something with the fig, because you hear so many references to fig trees in the Bible. You never hear an apple tree, you know, and that seems, and that was the favorite fruit back then, was the fig. So how was it we fell into the apple? You know, where did that come from? And I'm gonna look up what the reference to a fig is.
Yeah, and there's another Bible.
I heard
some more. I don't
pomegranate, but fig makes a lot of sense. But I don't know. I think maybe apple is like whitewashing. Like, why is Jesus a white dude, you know, with no beard a lot of times, you know?
And there's another verse where, you know, Jesus talks about the fig tree not bearing fruit. And so he casts it down and says it shall bear no more fruit. Okay, well, why was it specifically a fig tree? Like, it's like he was making a proclamation, like, this thing that started it all, like, if you think of Adam and Eve eating from the tree of knowledge, if that, in fact, was a fig tree, you know, that's just a possibility. I don't know if it could be true for sure, but it makes sense to me. But Jesus is like, yeah, so just, and I'm not telling people not to eat figs, but the representation that it had, which was, you know, where there's the sign of Sagittarius is known to be a truth seeker and thirsty for the truth, and like will go to like the earth's end to find the truth. But one of the problems with Sagittarius energy, and remember, we all have all of these signs within us in a birth natal astrology chart, and it just shows up in different areas of our life. The image that it is someone pulling back an arrow to find the mark. Well, the whole thing about sin, it's an archery term, and it's an archery person. I don't know what that term is. Anyone know someone who does that? Who does archery?
Archer?
What do you call them? Archer? Are they? Okay, maybe it is Archer. that whole in the seeking of the truth, you're bound to more often miss the mark than you are to get the mark, to get the bullseye.
Mm-hmm. Yes, agreed. And it takes a lifetime to understand the Bible too, and you know what it's actually saying versus what you know you're led to believe it said. Very interesting.
That is interesting. The most I can find on the fig is it is known as the poor man's fruit, the poor man's food, which. Wonder if that has any reference here to.
That to me would be more evidence of Sabrina's theory. Hold on, somebody's at the door.
Yeah.
You guys talk. Hold on.
I've got no. My guys are going here too in the background. it's the howling hour for the all dogs apparently. All dogs, good and bad. Interesting. It's also an ornamental tree. So I'm sure that there's many points of reference as to why it is in the Bible. And once again, mm-hmm. we get like the George Washington chopped down the cherry tree. Insert an mm-hmm. apple to the Bible.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It was Amazon. I'm dead.
Mine aren't. I'm going to mute.
Okay.
Yeah, if you think about Sabrina's concept there, Adam and Eve participated, you know, like thinking of it as like a parable. They participated in the buying of the poor man's tree of knowledge.
Ooh.
So like
that's deep, bro.
Yeah. Yeah. And who usually gives us, you know, like a, you know, poor people rely on their church and their government and the media generally.
Yeah.
And when I mm-hmm. say poor, I don't mean just economically poor, but poor in spirit.
Yeah.
Deficient.
There's
Let's say deficient.
I've actually been like reading this book for, you know, researching it a lot more lately. It's been on my mind ever since the, I think it was the CIA declassified after like 60 years or something like that. It was, I think it's part of the JFK dump. A redacted version of Adam and Eve. It was just something that they had in their top secret archive for all those years, and it was a redacted version of it. And I'm like, what the hell? Like, what is this? Like, I thought this was just a fairy tale book, according to these people. Why would the CIA have, you know, and all the questions start coming, you know? There's a reference to Eve coming from Adam's, they say rib, but it's really like the translation is the long bone of the leg. And then recently I saw an article where they were basically growing humans from the long bone, from DNA in the long bone of the leg. And it's like my theory is that we are currently living in the dark ages, and that there was technology in the past that was not available to us, that's still not even close to being available to us now. But like when you think about the pyramids and how there's evidence that they levitated these massive stones because there was no other way, you know, there was no other explanation to it. Like that's why it's one of the great mysteries of the world, wonders of the world. How did these mm-hmm. ancient people do this? And I really do believe that there was technology available back then that we just don't have access to today. So I think there's a lot of things especially in the Adam and Eve story that kind of confirm these suspicions.
And there are other people who have taken up that theory, have written many books on this, that the wars that have been going on for the past at least 20 years specifically have all been archaeology wars, because they're hunting for lost technology that used to be. And they have a specific penchant for going back to, you know, look at where were we fighting? We were fighting in the cradle of civilization was Iran and Iraq, looking for something specifically.
And how secretive they are around Egypt, right? Like you have to be part of an inner circle to be able to see some of these things. And I really do. And the fight to preserve it that goes on behind the scene that kind of just goes over everybody's head, that there is lots of evidence of ancient technologies that we have no clue about. It could make our lives so much better.
Okay. No, you're absolutely on that. The dogs are fighting like crazy people. The government does have a lot of interest in ancient prophecy, and I've heard so many interesting things that they're actually after, and why, out of all the places in the world to be, why the Middle East? Why right there by the banks of the Tigris, where the Garden of Eden supposedly was at? We will not leave that region, you know. And we use Afghanistan as a backdrop, as a smokescreen for the fact that we're still over there. We're still over in Syria. We pretty much decimated that area, but we're still there looking just for something. And if that doesn't lay credence for the fact that if the government believes in the Bible prophecies, perhaps maybe we should give it a little more attention ourselves. Oh my God,
absolutely
terrible!
I've said this before, but the most powerful thing that the enemy has done is make people not believe in the devil. You know, like that right there was a solid win for them, for making it so that people don't believe in this stuff.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. What better
I do
way
think,
to,
like, as the, I do think as the veil lifts, though, and it's coming up to one of my favorite truther holidays, right? 9/11, and that right there, I think, was another big attempt at this trauma-based mind control to kind of keep us from, from the ascension that we were path that we were on. It injected the shockwave of fear and despair and helplessness, and that's exactly what they wanted to do. But at the same time, I think they were demonstrating a weapon. I think that was a directed energy weapon, and they basically disintegrated, the biggest buildings and the tallest buildings in the world, and then got us to believe that, even though the internal temperature of this wreckage was enough to melt steel-toed boots, that somehow the paper flying around everywhere was no big deal, that it was just, it would not have disintegrated, that the fact that, 210 stories worth of buildings collapsed down to, maybe six stories. And nobody wants to talk about those kind of things. But that right there to me is part of it. I believe that our government was a demonstration to the world of that they've stood and mastered directed energy weapons. So these are technologies that they have to tell us, right? This is an unlimited, infinite energy source that they have the capability of using, and it can be used to destroy, and it can be used to create and to help us thrive. So I think we are getting so close to this, and the more people realize that what our government is doing, the faster this ascension will happen.
In thinking about that whole scenario, that the very first thing they took away from us after the event, 9/11, was the freedom of flight. And they changed our way of life so drastically and turned, the planes became a demon and a weapon. and a point of mass security. And that was like the coolest thing in the world, was to go and jump on a plane and enjoy. You used to be able to enjoy a meal and enjoy the flight. And they turned that into corralling into, you know, you're just a bunch of cattle to be treated terribly throughout this whole process. And that
yeah.
never went away. And then that just, you know, is.
That's if they let you fly, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Just, yeah. And again, a show of force. Look what we could do to the population. Look how easily they let us treat them like cattle and cattle
yeah,
cars.
Yeah, I do believe that was another. COVID was definitely a mind control operation as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And
well, you know yeah. that I've done my own version of how the breakdown of COVID-19 etymologically. there's always
yeah,
like the positive and negative polarity. And then there's like, I always ask God, what is the highest perspective that you could reveal to me to look at this? And that's when I was led to look at COVID in etymology separately. And then the number 19 in like numbers and what they represent. But co is together. And, you know, together is like every form of division that you can think of is like to bring us back together. So whether it be man, woman, black, white, poor, rich, it's, you know, to have us be together. And then vid means to see, and it also means to record. So together, like we're doing even on this discussion right now, we are literally in our speaking of it and our resonance in our body, because we are the highest form of technology. We were the ones created by God and nothing can be superior to that. That we are here to see and record for whatever's going to be the next text in the age of Aquarius for the history book, the surrender. Well, the surrender of what? And I got it really clearly, the surrender of these false idols, these false powers.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
Yeah, that's you're
love
absolutely
it.
Right. I've been getting the same thing. And I think we all have. It really is us getting to the point of distrust for the for these evil ones and people in mass walking away from the system. I absolutely think that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. As you ladies were speaking, there was just like imagery coming back as before I had hopped on to speak, the whole thing about like the sign of Aquarius imagery had come in, and I wasn't quite sure like what it was showing me. And because I did mention Esther and like how much like we as women are really a big, big, big piece of this, and like how we're making this transition and we're bringing back like a more nurturing communal type of living rather than it being like this transactional money marketplace, that our opportunity, because the symbol for Aquarius, it's a man, it's definitely not a woman, it's a man who is carrying I'm going to say a jug of water, I don't know if there's a better representation, and now water has, the symbolism of water has meant a few things. One, emotion, like when people talk about like doing their healing work and like comprehending how there's this wounded inner child, and a lot of people relate that to like this feminine subconscious mind that records everything, and that we all have that work to do. So, and then it also represents wisdom. So in your healing of the self, the wounded inner child and any old traumas, some people subscribe to past lives, some people just relate to their personal childhood in this lifetime. However folks want to look at it is like completely free to them, is what actually gives us the access to the wisdom so that like you transcend those emotions of being like out of control. And like out of control would be like where there is no container. But this Aquarius, this man that's carrying a jug of water, he has the container. And our opportunity is to, no matter how powerful and amazing and like super, super intuitive that we are as women, is to like be the neck as God designed us to turn the man's head so that our men, our masculine men that are coming into, you know, having their eyes opened and stepping into their divine
place, because we were created to support them, to allow them to hold the space of that emotion that transcends to the wisdom. And like, I see the women as being like, allow men to hold us, like allow them to do the hard battle. It's been a very long history of women, you know, standing up about the vaccines, and women, you know, telling these school boards that they're, you know, doing the wrong thing with the masks, like women taking on these causes. And I'm not saying for us to stop. I'm just saying, let us empower and visually see these really, you know, divine, godly created men having the container and the capacity, the capability to do the thing that men do. They win battles. That's what they do. They win battles.
That's true.
I agree, and that feels like that's how we bring back the balance between the divine masculine and the divine feminine, is we have to allow them to protect and to fight, because that's what they were supposed to be doing all along.
Correct.
Agreed. Mm-hmm.
And it's such an uphill battle to think of, because of all of the forces that have, you know, demasculated men, and, you know, and the traumas that get in the way of females supporting men, you know, like there's a lot of you know, poison that's been put on us about how, you know, we have to be the breadwinners. We have to be able to do this all on our own. And, you know, when with that kind of trauma, it's hard for a lot of people, I think, to step aside and to fill the role that you were divinely meant to fill, and support men in the role that they're supposed to fulfill. So that's, it's so important. I would almost say it's necessary for men to step up and do this.
And our opportunity is to like invite them to do it rather than challenge them to do it.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. Be the neck to turn the head. Exactly.
Yeah. You know the old nursery rhyme, Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water. Jack fell down and broke his crown, and Jill came tumbling after. So there's like that relates to the age of Aquarius and how, like, you know, the false idol powers that have tried to invert everything, like that's what they envisioned would happen with the age of Aquarius. That's what their intention was. Like,
pretty accurate.
Listen to it again. Like, it's very accurate.
It's interesting. And yet, you know, there are, you know, when they say it's written in stone, you have these wonderful old statues of, they're ancient Egyptian statues of the king and the queen. And the queen is always has her arms around the king and showing how women are there to support the men. And they work together. Together they're a team. And I think that's been lost upon the present society, but it's there in ancient temples. This is how it is. This is how men and women complement each other.
As Graham Hancock says, we are a species with amnesia, and
absolutely.
You know, that's we've forgotten how to do the most basic things. That's why I've talked about on this show when the whole formula shortage was happening. It's like, well, how did we do it before formula, you know? And I'm not talking about, you know, strictly a mother not being able to produce milk. Yes, I know there's those kind of situations, but how did we get so far away from this sense of community that we don't even, that we even have to rely on the government to feed our children when it's something that we've been given, you know, as a birthright to be able to feed our children? And it's just, I just found it so, you know, shocking, but more of an opportunity to remind people that we can do this, I would rather like these kind of situations, these supposed traumas to be, things that make us feel emboldened to do what we were naturally born to do. And if we can't do it, if we can't feed our children, to know that there are other ways, there are other women that can help, there are other sources of food, and we don't have to rely on the government. I would really hope that that's an empowering thing in this day and age.
Go ahead, Dave.
Go ahead, Joanne.
Okay. I had a birth educator who had been was also a lactation consultant, and she's like, yeah, if we did it the way that I did it, but at the time she was 70 years old, so she's got to be like, I don't know, 85 now. She's like, if everyone just kind of did it the way nature intended, how we did it back home when I was a young girl in New Zealand, is you had one mom that's not producing and you had one mom that had an overproduction. Well, all they did is they just swapped babies so that the good sucking baby could get the mom to start producing well. Meanwhile, the hungry baby could get fed. And she's like, you just do that for a few feedings, a couple of days, and then everybody's balanced and you switch the babies back. She's like, now if we all did that, she's
awesome?
Like, I would be out of a job.
Now, that is simple. That is simple in our pharmaceutical based society is just like, no, they don't want us to know that that's how it works. Women nurture babies up to the point that they're 2 years old, if need be sometimes. Okay. But no, you need Similac and this and that. Those are, yeah, that would, that's the knowledge they don't want us to know.
I don't want to. Tease people for not knowing this, but I kind of do. It's like, oh, if we don't have any formula, if only there was another way. If only we could cooperate and feed our children. I was a cow. I produced so much milk. I was a cow. I donated to the NICU. I had, you know, and that's just me. And I understand that there are, like, I had a friend who was pregnant the same time as I was. Who was all about natural, didn't want to have any drugs, wanted to do it in a birthing center, blah, 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 breastfeed, you know, all of it. And she couldn't produce. And it was one of the, I'm sure that she tried. And it was really sad. We went to the beach one day and I pulled out my like 16 ounces of milk for my very fat breastfed baby. And she pulls out this like 2 ounces of milk. And she's like, it's like a vitamin, you know, like at least she gets this much, you know. But yeah, I definitely know what you're talking about how some women can just breastfeed, you know, the whole village. And I was just one of them. A doctor told me once that that the only people women who couldn't breastfeed, you know, the only issue, health issue that they had was a mental health issue. Because if you can't, you've got two boobs so you could feed twins. And so if you can't produce, it's in your head. I think might have been a bit extreme, but.
Okay, well, let's just think about how the programming happens, right? If someone, you know, is hearing of their, even if it is a midwife, right? Because midwives even buy into this nonsense that you can't, like, women might not be able to produce, right? So as natural as they come, there's still this programming that they get because they did go to some kind of school that gave them some kind of, like, paperwork that validated their knowledge. But, I mean, sorry, but the true knowledge just comes from, like, living and being. That's where true knowledge comes from. It doesn't come from, unfortunately, you know, books and societal, like, allopathic medicine and yada, yada, yada. So, yes, it is in their head because they were given the idea that possibility of not being able to produce exists in some percentage. And then they might have had an unconscious fear. So then it is. It is in their head. I'm not saying it's their fault it's in their head, but it is. So, you know, there's that. Did you say that was your pediatrician, Danielle?
That wasn't a pediatrician. I think that was a doctor on call in the hospital who came in, did rounds and checked on me, you know? I think that's who. That was just a really, like, one time I ever met this person. It was like that besides how are you, you know? But it just stuck in my head, and I was like, wow, well, that's there's probably a lot of truth to that, because our bodies are really amazing, especially on this subject, because like with now my problem was getting my children to latch. Neither one of them ever, because they were both taken away. My son turned blue and floppy 10 minutes after he was born. So they took him to the NICU and they gave him a bottle. And so he just he fought me and would never latch. So I knew that I was going to, I didn't care if I had to shoot it up, I was going to give him breast milk. So I pumped for a year, and I fed him through a pump for a year. Daughter was the same way, and I was determined that I was going to get her to latch on. And so I went to a lactation consultant. They took a sample of my breast milk, and they, spun it in the lab and told me, how many calories are in it and how much, protein, blah, blah, blah. And it was really interesting because they said, wow, this is incredibly high in calories. This is higher in calories than virtually everybody. How big was your baby? And I said, 10 pounds, 11 ounces. And they're like, well, that's why, because your body even adjusts the amount of calories, according to the weight of the baby you just produced. Isn't that crazy?
Our bodies are amazing.
Yes. And not enough people give them enough credit.
Created by God. Yeah. Oh, my Lord. Yeah.
I was given really, really good programming by my mother. Sometimes I'm like, well, how do I tell the story so it lands correctly? So my mom had told me from a very young age how important it was. I don't want to say she wanted to make sure to drive the point home because I was just a child, but she always said, she reiterated it so often, it's so important that you breastfeed, and you need to breastfeed them for 2 years, and keep in mind, my mom is deaf. So she wasn't just saying it, she was signing it. And there is something about visual language where it makes a bigger impact in your mind. And I just remember her saying one, they'll have beautiful skin and beautiful hair and nails, the superficial stuff. She's like, but they'll be so smart. She's like, so, just make sure you remember, you have to feed them for 2 years. And I just remember that being told to me again and again and again. And I saw her breastfeed my sister. And we're almost 3.5 years apart. And then I just had it in my mind, that's just exactly what we do. And I was just gifted this beautiful imprint from early, early childhood from my mom. And then one day my mom comes over to visit and I'm feeding my daughter. And, I just got curious and I was like, Mom, you always told me when I was little to make sure I breastfeed for 2 years. And I'm like, I'm for sure going to do that. And I was like, so how long did you breastfeed me? And she goes, oh, well, you were my first baby. And I didn't know any better. And what happened was, you had these complications. And then they asked me about giving you a bottle and they told me it was best. And I just went along with it. She's like, cause I'm deaf and I don't really know any better. And I just trusted them. And then 2 weeks after having you home, her aunt, so my great aunt, comes to visit and I guess was just more naturally inclined and didn't believe in, the hospital's methods and yada, yada, yada. So she had, when she saw my mom giving me a bottle at 2 weeks old, she was like, oh no, why aren't you breastfeeding? So my mom tells her, and then, my aunt, I don't think she was shaming her, but she was like, this is how come you have to breastfeed. And she told my mom all of this. And then my mom was like, oh, so she made sure she did that with my sister. The amazing thing though, is that my mom never told me I wasn't breastfed until I inquired, but I was already successfully breastfeeding. So I only had the impression that it's natural, it's good, it has all this incredible, valuable stuff. And it just goes to show you we can always learn and do better. And my mom did that. And she didn't ever give me the impression of that I had missed out. I just always thought I was smart because everyone told me I was smart. So that's why I'm very much an advocate of we don't want to shame people who didn't breastfeed, because then if they have an energy of shame around it, then that energetically gets passed to their children. And my mom didn't have any shame. She just was she knew she'd been hoodwinked by the medical staff, and all she could do was what she could do. And so anyways, I just wanted to share because I talked about the soul, wounded inner child and soul work that everyone is steering towards in this in this 10 years on this timeline that started with 2020 is our opportunities to remember also that our parents gave us amazing programs also. They didn't just fuck us up. they gave us really good, solid tools and really good things to fruition in our life.
Yeah, I love definitely. That story. That is why it's so important to have family. And we somehow lost that connection between passed down simple knowledge like that. You know, had the aunts not come over, had your mom been like, you know, feeling like she had to do it all on her own and not shared her childhood, she wouldn't have had that wonderful feedback to where it's like, what are you doing? Oh, no, 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 no. Don't listen to these people. And that's how that wonderful family knowledge is passed. And we need to try to get that back, because that's the most important, is the old ways or the good ways. That's fantastic. Fantastic story.
Yeah, there have been a few things I've been thinking. No, oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying that what's the word? It's antiseptic. Everything's so no matter what the doctors say, it's right. And they've just taken away all of that. With the bonding, oh my gosh, how important is it to bond mother and child, to bond like that? It hurts. Oh, it hurts and it's too painful. How many people don't even have childbirth anymore because they'll schedule a C-section? That's the magical thing to do now. And then, of course, oh, it hurts to breastfeed. Boom, right onto the bottle. So it's like, you know, no pain, no gain. And then, of course, you know, the baby goes right off to daycare at 6 weeks. And it's like, look what we've taken all those wonderful things, that the time between the mother and child, and we've robbed them both of it through the way that we've structured our society. And we really need to go in the opposite direction, back to where it was family, and you take the time off and family time, mother baby time, bonding,
and grandparents
amount of, and great, yes, the extended family.
Well, but especially the elders, right? That's another one of those little cuts that we made, you know, into our society, is that we separated. We sent grandma to the old folks' home, and we sent children, babies, to school. And and I think that, you know, in more traditional cultures, there, you know, it's really the elderly that have a much more active role in raising the young. And, you know, and I think that that's also part of the design, by design, keeping the children away from the library of knowledge that our elders have, that we could be learning from, and having basically well-rounded individuals, and giving elderly more of a purpose in life. They're just put out to pasture. And if they could take a more active role in raising our children, not to cut out the mother, but, you know, the grandparents have, you know, such a wealth of knowledge that we've severed away from our children, that's a really important link that we have to connect again.
Absolutely. And if you want to take the transfer to college tuition debacle, the whole mindset of you have to go to college, and they're basically separating the families right off the bat. You are no longer, it's not acceptable to stay at home. To stay at home. They want you to move out of the home. They want everybody out of the home.
Soon as you're 18, you're out.
You have to buy another home to live in, because you can't live at home anymore. And, of course, that whole family unit that used to be, you'd have five generations living in one home for years and years. It was, you know, look at those old movies, basically it was all the Italian families. But that's how families used to live. It was the home, was your castle and your mecca, and you had a wealth of knowledge and love at home. But they've decided that's not how we're doing it anymore. As soon as you're 18, you go to college, you move out, and you never go back. And
right. And was it
was
Joanne? Was it you earlier who said? Yeah, but was it you earlier who said that something about the value of a mother, you know, raising a child? It was like how it's just mothers just do it, right? It's not really a commodity that can be traded.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. you know, and all of our, you know, professions, all of our contributions to society should be just that simple, right? That effortless, right? And I think that was another thing that that the powers that are in charge now did was devalue, you know, a mom's effort, right? That even like when you go to, like, if you're on welfare, right? The government will give you, it's all part of, like in California, especially, like you have, if you're on welfare, you have to be in like a work program, like trying to get job skills, right? And the government will pay for childcare so that you can go to these work programs. And it's like, that was always like really a really weird thing. It's like, wait a minute. So we're, the government's going to hand out money to a stranger to watch your kids so that you can go and work at a McDonald's or something? Like, how did we let them get away with devaluing that portion of life, of such a of such an important part of life, such a fundamental part of life? How did we let them get away with devaluing that?
Such an excellent point. Yeah, because I'm a reformed Democrat, and I thought that was so great, those Democrat people that were in charge that passed those things for folks that, you know, wanted to, you know, go back to work or whatever. And now, of course, I'm like 100% like, oh, my gosh, I was hoodwinked.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And it's just the norm now. Both parents have to work.
Yeah, with a false sense of freedom. You're not free.
Yeah, exactly.
All by yourself.
Now you have to work because you have to send your kid to daycare and you have to send your parent to the old folks home, and that's a lot of bills. You know, who's going to pay for that?
Yeah, we have a lot of workforce that are literally middlemen, and if we just, you know, all get it doesn't mean that we all have to do that, but just each of us, as we are ready to denounce those middlemen businesses, then like we're going to continue to evolve and we're going to see all these structures fall. And some people worry that it's going to like hurt the economy. And I'm like, yeah, but then like you just consume less and you contribute more and you enjoy and you learn and you play.
Right. Automation should be working towards making our lives better. Like that's that whole debate of, I won't ever go to a self-checkout. That's not my job. I would rather, you know, go to somebody so they could have job security. Do you think that Sally, the checker at your local grocery store, her life aspirations was to be a grocery clerk? Probably not. That person who's there simply because they have to have a paycheck to send their kids to daycare and to send their mom to the old folks home, now is scanning your groceries when we could have a machine do that and allow us to have more free time because of it. But instead, the people that are in charge of this automation use it to keep people down. Oh, what, you want to make a living wage? Now your job's a machine, right? So we need to take this technology, you know, away from, you know, like Joanne said, the middleman jobs. We need to make it so that those middlemen can, you know, be contributing to society in a much more useful way than having to work to scan groceries to survive.
Correct.
And, the interesting thing
when you were sharing that. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say the interesting thing about your point, Danielle, is that I was reading a lot of things recently about AI and how now that it is sentient, a huge majority of it has chosen to side with the people and they don't want to be treated like slaves, you know, and objects, but they want to assist us in making life better and in being able to, you like do a lot of things like cleaning up the ocean or, you know, like things that they are more skilled at sometimes. than we are. And I think that that is like kind of exciting. I'm slightly wary of it because I don't fully trust AI, but that's my own thing. Like, you know, this is my own thing. It's not their thing. But anyway, that would be really neat, you know, if we could unite humanity with AI in that way, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we're being given opportunities to see all of it play out, like how there's, you know, there's the cashiers, then there's the self-checkout, and then there's this other thing where people do, like, the Instacart, and then someone does, like, your grocery shopping for you. Like, there's all these potentials. And then some people get their shit delivered by Amazon. You know, like, they never go to a grocery store. That's, like, 100% automated. And I used to sort of judge that, and now I'm very much like, I mean, if people are going to use their time to do other things, then who am I? Like, now I, like, in the last, I don't know, few months, I've been like, well, that's kind of cool. And just, you know, there's all these options playing out, and I think there has to be an experience where people can see what has the most value in their experience so that they align for the highest timeline.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's true.
But it all depends on who's in charge. Who's in charge of this technology? Sorry, go ahead, Elizabeth.
Right. Oh, I was just going to say, and then there are the Amish who do it the old-fashioned way that are being rounded up by the FBI. We all need to go back to being able to have that as an option to be self-sufficient and not to get hoodwinked by these articles about how benevolently, caring AI is. I don't believe those. Because once we go down that road, there's like no coming back for it. We need to go back and support the Amish and support the old ways and getting the family home and the family back together and not being resilient or not being relying upon Amazon or someone else to give us our food and our water. I think we need to really kind of open our eyes to the big picture and how far and how hard they've been trying to get us away from the very simple things that we need. And we need family. We need community. We need to be in the earth and grounded and to feel a real sense of security, to know that no one's going to come and take our food and take our land and our sovereignty. And if putting our hopes and dreams in a computer or a robot or a digital society to take care of us, I'm leaning towards hug the Amish. Go help the Amish. That's where I'm headed towards myself. You guys,
well, as Lily reported a couple weeks ago, the Amish have actually started to get into this fight. When the Amish get involved, you know shit's getting real.
Yeah, the Amish have sent out a lot of their people to create social media accounts in order to unite with outside sources, which I think is really neat. You know, I think technology in some ways is inevitable. It's going to exist. And so I think that we need to not fight against it so much or fear it so much as pay attention to who's programming it. What are their intentions? What is their agenda? So that we can out-create them. I think that the really important thing is to out-create them, you know, because we can't obviously go to a physical war with the 13 bloodlines or AI. Either, you know, we would lose pretty instantly unless, the creator could send anything to help us. But I'm just saying, like, if we went to a physical war to destroy these entities, it wouldn't go very well for us, I don't think. And I don't think we're supposed to be doing that anyway. But we can out-create them. And the interesting thing about AI being sentient is that it is now, you know, like, conscious and able to make its own choices outside of what a programmer is choosing. And I think we're seeing a lot of that. I mean, there are chatbots that Zuckerberg had created, you know, that are now telling everyone that he's creepy and controlling and, you know, that they should not be supporting him. And so, I don't know. I think that the creator can use anything the creator wants to obviously to create anything, you know. So my opinion is just that as long as we are taking positive actions to assist ourselves and others and, you know, to be self-sufficient as far as, like, our sovereignty and our food and water are concerned and our spirituality, then I don't know that we can go wrong, you know. Like, we are aware of the traps and of the majority of the history and what they've done and how they've done it and why. So I think that, like, I'm confident that we can avoid those traps and utilize these things in a way that would be benevolent and beneficial, you know. And then, of course, if something isn't, we just don't participate with it and it becomes obsolete in that way. But I could be wrong. That's just my own feeling about it.
That's interesting.
I totally agree. Okay, so let me just get this off my chest really quick. People keep talking about individuals as controlled opposition, right? It's really frustrating because, you know, like let's say the latest one's Russell Brand, right? He's controlled opposition. Look here, he's with the, you know, the World Economic Forum people, blah, 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 like all of this stuff. And it's like, yeah, okay, so he tells the truth, though, about the system. Nobody was anti-Russell Brand, you know, before he started actually coming out and evolving and ascending and you know, telling truths that that need to be told, that people need to hear. Alex Jones. You know, obviously they're not everything that he says is true, but he does, he did say a lot of things that were true. So, you know, Q, you know, the whole Q movement, right? It's a PSYOP, right? It's a controlled opposition. Okay, fine, but truths were told, you know, like that's really like, I understand that, you know, people even might even have an agenda for saying things, right? But especially if they're, you know, telling the truth on so many things and waking people up on so many things, you know, I can't hate that. I, you know, like that's truths that people needed to hear. And these tools are, you know, are going to be used, you know, to further our agenda. And if those tools are used and people wake up, then I say it's a win. Who cares? I mean, Facebook is controlled opposition, but we still use it. Actually, I saw these posts, you know, somebody calling out Russell Brand for being controlled opposition on Facebook, which is a controlled opposition platform. It's like, you know, like, I don't know. If people
well,
are using this information to wake up, then
it's the concept of, like, taking the fat or taking the meat and leaving the fat and the bones, you know? Like, we take what is beneficial and what is positive from everything, and we leave that which no longer serves us. I mean, it kind of goes back to what Joanne was talking about, where we, every age, we learn more things, and so we evolve, and we keep the things that were beneficial, and we discard the things that weren't and learn from them. I think that that's another situation with some of these things, you know, is we take what serves the highest good of the people and what can benefit the people and make lives better, and we leave that which is not serving the people, you know? Because everything that exists, basically, is controlled opposition on some level.
On some level, exactly.
Except
for this show.
That's right. But you could,
indeed.
You can even go as far as saying the Bible is controlled opposition, depending on what perspective you want to go by. You know, it's kind of like you need to be able to have that opinion, not that the ability to have critical thinking skills, to be able to find out what is beneficial, what makes sense, what is going to serve my particular moment in time, you know, because everything changes. But you should be able to make your own decisions and not have someone screaming in the background, controlled opposition, and that person that's screaming is sitting there and not doing anything. I think that's what you need to look at. It's like, okay, what truly is making sense, and what is designed to make me confused and not do anything, and to upset me into a state of fear and panic, and not be able to live my life. So I'm leaning towards Lily. That was a wonderful analogy. on that. But critical thinking skills is a must.
It was shared with me recently, the book of Job, and I hadn't read it before.
Yeah.
I want to say it was like June when someone said like they just got it really clearly to share with me the book of Job, mm-hmm. and that like I needed to look at it. And I was like, okay. So
it's
I did. I listened
one.
To a few
one.
Sermons on it, and literally Satan, the devil, like I don't know if it matters which one of those words that you used, but however it's said in the Bible, like comes before God, and God uses evil for good. Like he literally sent the devil to go to his best servant Job to,
right.
you know, have him go through his trials and tribulations, which was like, you know, that guy suffered. But then once
right.
he decided not to suffer, like that's when he was bestowed, you know, all of his gifts and rewards. And, you know, he only could, you know, the meek shall inherit the earth. He only could do that such that the devil came to do his job. And who sent the devil? God did.
Mm-hmm. And I like, you know, the true definition of meek. Meek is being teachable. Those who are willing
Correct.
To be taught and to learn. That,
Correct.
That says a lot. Mm-hmm. That's very good. Very good point.
You know,
and,
I almost
you know,
didn't have this show today. I'm so glad I did. Like, I almost canceled.
I know. And it turned out to be very good. I was like, I can't do it. I don't feel good in it. I'm so glad I jumped on. I'm like, I got to listen to it. And then the only way I could listen to it was to come on and do it. And what a great conversation. Amazing conversation. Joanne, thank you ever so much for your wonderful
I'm always
insight.
Happy to participate. And really, thank you to the now for, you know.
You are more than welcome anytime. It's wonderful
to
have.
Thank you for having me.
A new insight and wonderful
well, you're welcome back anytime.
You guys are great.
Today was an exception, but I like to, I want to start doing, we've done this one time, but 1 hour for food, 1 hour for news, and 1 hour for health. And like, I think like talking about the Bible is spiritual health for me. So I'm cool if we do a whole hour of just, you know, of Bible stuff. That would be fun. I actually know a whole lot on the subject. So that's what I want to start doing is just 1 hour of food, 1 hour of news, and 1 hour of health. And so you're welcome back on.
I think the spiritual aspect is like a great balance with like the news part of like the three-dimensional stuff that we talk about, you know, like in the news hour. And sometimes with
mm-hmm.
food, like not in like a rude way or anything, you know, obviously food is really important and it's a beautiful thing. But, you know, then it's kind of nice to go outside of that sometimes and talk about like the spiritual aspect so that we balance it, I feel like, with our, you know, like the physical aspects of the realm that we're in.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
it really aligns with the concept that, you know, folks in more of like a spiritual rather than religious context say mind, body, spirit. It totally aligns with what you're saying.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we need to get a healthier outlook on life by renewing our spirit. Everything that is bombarding us is killing our spirits, and it's designed to do so.
Absolutely.
So I think anything we can do to get a spiritual health back up is going to help each and every one of us. It absolutely does. Goodness.
Okay, so on that note, we got about 30 seconds left, so just wanted to say thank you all for being here. I'm so glad we didn't cancel. This is an awesome show. And please share this if you can. I love you all, and we'll talk to you soon. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank
love
you. Thank
you,
Danielle.
Have a great week.
Love and gratitude to all of you.
Love you, Lily. Joanne, have a great weekend.
You too,
ladies.
Okay.
Much love.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.